This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Hey gang, just two quick reminders of events coming up over the next week or so. On Tuesday, June 18th, at the San Francisco Cooking School from 7 to 9 p.m., I will be doing a live show. The headliner guest will be Chef Preeti Mistry, and that conversation will be followed by a panel discussion with five chefs who worked with the late, great Judy Rogers of the Zuni Cafe over the course of her illustrious career. And then on Saturday, June 22nd, I will be at the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the Chef's Garden in Ohio. They will be putting on a totally 80s dinner. Guest chefs will be David Waltuck of the late great Chanterelle restaurant in New York City and Claudia Fleming, currently of the North Fork Table and Inn in Long Island, New York, and of course, formerly the pastry chef of such landmark restaurants as Gramercy Tavern in New York City. You can link through to tickets and information about both via our Instagram feed. The handle there is @chefpodcast. Hope to see you there.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I think the strangest thing that came from the movie was I was on a dive boat in Cozumel, and the kid who doesn't speak any English, a Mayan kid, barely speaks Spanish. He came over to me and said, I love your movie. And I was like, what? How is that possible? Of course, it's Netflix. But I think that was the biggest surprise of all.
That is the legendary chef, Jeremiah Tower, interviewing with me in the back seat of a car.
That's the bond that bonds me to everybody who's worked for the site.
Mm-hmm.
We shared values, you know, and to me, that's the most important thing in a business,
yeah,
or a marriage or anything else. It's, yeah, like if you share values, and that's you. It's interesting that you recognize that because it's totally true.
And that is Ed Levine, the founder of the website Serious Eats and author of the new book Serious Eater. Our guest today on a doubleheader episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. And can I be honest? I'm having a rough week. I am maxed out. I have been running from place to place. Caitlin is out of town. I'm alone with our children and our dog. Our house looks like a bachelor's apartment. It is an absolute, looks like a hurricane went through. I did not have anybody to do this intro with me. And as long-term listeners know, I kind of need somebody to talk to. It makes life easier for me. That little thing I do at the beginning of the show where I say, hey, gang, and tell you about upcoming appearances, I just tried to do that five different times. It's still not good. I got a little marble mouth, that part of it. But I got to get to another interview I'm doing in the city that starts in an hour and 20 minutes. So I need to slap this thing together and get out the door. I had a lot of things I wanted to talk about this week, and I don't have time. I do have great guests, so I'm trying to, you know, evolve a little on the perfectionist front, and I'm going to just introduce these guests because I don't think they need a whole lot of bells and whistles around them, and I think you're going to love this show. It's really a terrific one. So first up, we have Ed Levine. He's not a chef. We once in a while on this show do what we call an open kitchen episode. Ed created the website Serious Eater. I imagine a lot of you spend time there. And he just published yesterday on June 10th, which happens to be actually the morning I'm recording this, but the show won't air until Wednesday, his memoir. And I'll introduce that in just a moment. That is followed by a really special thing. I was at the Chef's Roll anti-convention in San Diego in April. We did a special episode from there. The guest of honor at that anti-convention was Jeremiah Tower. Everyone listening to this, I'm sure, must know who Jeremiah is. He was the guy who, in a lot of ways, put Chez Panisse on the map as the second chef there. And then, of course, Stars Restaurant was his restaurant in the 1980s. It's one of the great classic American restaurants, one of the most influential restaurants in the history of American cuisine and American restaurant culture. He was the guest of honor. I snagged an interview with him, and I also sat down with two different groups of alumni of Stars Restaurants, all of whom are still quite active in the restaurant business, and we talked about Jeremiah. So it's an interview with JT, as they call him, and then an interview with these six people broken up into two different groups. So that will follow the mid-show break, about an hour into the show. But first of all, I want to introduce what I think is just a great interview, Ed Levine. Some of you may have heard me on his show. Gosh, I guess it was last year when my book came out. But Ed is, to me, one of the all-time good guys in the food writing business. He's an absolute mensch, to use an overused word. He's really smart. He has great taste, but he has it in what I consider a very unsnobby way. You know, there are food writers who kind of feel the need to name check a lot of things in very flowery French accents or show off their Italian. And there's nothing wrong with that. Ed's somebody I think of when I want to know, as other people do, you know, where's the best pizza? Where's the best burger? Where's the best Turkish food in New York? Like, this is the kind of thing I would go to someone like Ed Levine for. He loves that food. He also loves, you know, whatever you want to call it. I've stopped using adjectives like more sophisticated fare, because I think any good food is sophisticated. It's one of the things I've learned doing this show. But Ed has a memoir. This episode will drop on June 11th, 2019. The memoir came out June 10th, and I sat down with him a few weeks ago. The memoir is called Serious Eater, A Food Lover's Perilous Quest for Pizza and Redemption. And the book is both the story of how Ed created the website, developed the website, eventually sold the website quite profitably, but it's also a very honest look at how long it took to make it into something that one could sell. And to be honest, what it took to keep it afloat for so many years. It took a lot, and the book tells it all. Ed and I sort of talk around what's in the book because I want you all to buy it. I don't want to, you know, spoil too much, but we sort of embellish the book so that you can enjoy the interview and still go get it. I think I'm going to leave it there. With that, I'm going to introduce you now to my interview with Chef Ed Levine, recorded at the office of his publisher a few weeks ago in New York City. Here you go. I asked you for a sound check.
Yeah.
And you started saying what you had for breakfast.
Oh, it was chorizo and eggs at Eli's. Eli's son runs a coffee bar on like 79th and 3rd.
Okay.
And even though it's in a chafing dish, so God knows when they were made, they were actually pretty tasty, and the coffee's okay. But so that's what I had for breakfast.
See, this is among other things, like that you created this huge website and did what you did with it. This is the difference between me and like you and every other food writer I know. Like that would not even occur to me to be my sound check. To just start talking about what I had to eat that day.
Exactly.
You know, I think about the late Josh Ozersky, who over in the corner of his blog had like his last meal at all times.
Yes.
You know, like that's your
That's what I do.
That's your thing.
And
that's
I don't
your
even
life.
Know why I do that with the guests. Like when you were
on. Oh, that's what you always do for a soundcheck?
That's what I always do on Special Sauce is ask. I'm sure I asked you when you were on.
I don't remember. It would have been the same answer every day, though, and it would not be true. It would be a protein shake.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Made with dried peanut butter and soy milk, and it's not a culinary experience I have in the morning. I do have good coffee.
Yeah. No, it's look, that's how we roll, man. Let's face it.
Okay. You
know, it is how we roll.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
You know, when you and I first talked about it, which wasn't that long ago, the book was written, and I don't remember, but you were struggling for a subtitle.
Oh, yes, I struggled. That's probably the 100th subtitle.
We had dinner at Raza.
Yes, that's right.
Right, a pizza place that you love, as many people do.
With Bill Telepan.
And at the time, you had a really, I don't remember what it was, but it was like a pretty boring.
It was.
And you were like,
it was like a joyride.
It had the root.
Thrill ride or joyride through business.
Yes. And I was like, and like, I love titles. I'm usually good at them.
Oh, right. You told me that. We had a long discussion about this.
No, we spent a lot tonight. Yeah. And I went home. I never told you this, but I was like forever in my mind. I was like, for like days. I'm
please
like,
don't
I want to, I want to, no, well, no, I wanted to solve it and write you an email and be like the hero. And then when I got the galley, which I'm holding in my hand, a food lover's perilous quest for pizza and redemption. I was like, thank God. That is a really good subtitle.
It's true.
I believe you will sell more books with this subtitle
yes,
than the
I
other
do
one.
Too. People, you know who you can tell? It makes people smile and laugh.
Yeah.
And you know, look, for me, and I think for you and for most people that do what we do, but especially for us, you know, food is about pleasure and food is about fun.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that this process of building a website, starting it as a food blog, and then making it work as a business was all fun and games, because it most assuredly was not.
Right.
But, you know, as Kenji says...
This is Kenji
Lopez-Alt,
who most people probably know, is a breakout star of the site.
Exactly.
And the writer and the creator of the Food Lab.
Right. Yeah. And wrote the foreword. He said something in the foreword about, for Ed, food is all about pleasure, you know? And so the publisher of the imprint, Adrian Zakheim, kept saying to me, and so did the editor, Mary Sun, who's this wonderkin, amazing editor. She kept driving, I need more food in this chapter. I need more food in this chapter.
Yeah.
And my friend Zach Brooks, you know, who runs Smorgasburg LA, you probably know, said, I love how you think you can convince people at every meeting with the food you bring.
Yes, that is a constant in the book. It's not where you take them. But here's what I wanted to ask you. When you just said food is pleasure. First of all, I should tell you, we didn't talk about this before we started recording. We're gonna talk around the periphery of the book.
Sure.
Because I don't want to spoil the book, right? Yeah. So I'm gonna keep the details, the revelations, a little vague, so people have a reason to go get the book, which everyone should do, right?
Yeah, because as Kenji, I think it does, and I took this as the highest compliment. He said it reads like a novel, you know, and it's weird because you know I'm not one of these people who inhales novels, you know, like I just, you know, I write conversationally. I don't set scenes particularly well, but
you don't sit there and agonize for 3 days over one word.
Exactly,
you're happy to describe something as awesome or delicious or great.
I regard myself as a storyteller.
Yes, as opposed to like a poet. Right,
absolutely.
You don't take that as a criticism.
Yeah, no. I love telling stories in any medium.
Yeah. So what I was going to say to you, though, you just said to me, you know, food is about pleasure, and right? And I feel like, well, I mentioned Josh a few minutes ago. He was kind of the ultimate of this, right? But I feel like a lot of people turn to writing out of pain. And I feel like a lot of people actually, he was brilliant about this. Some people turn to food out of pain, and some food writers turn to both things out of pain, right? To, as he used to say, to fill voids in your life that aren't filled elsewhere. Now, I always thought of you as more sort of like the bon vivant model, like a Jewish Coleman Andrews, you know, like a sophisticated guy with good taste who liked to sit around and have a drink. Maybe for you, it wasn't rosé, blah, blah, blah. It was maybe it was a good beer or a cream soda and a great sandwich.
A diet cherry
or something like that, right? Okay. But you do talk about in this book, again, I don't want to get too specific, but you did have some pain in your late childhood.
For sure.
You had some family Sturm und Drang. Yeah, and you do talk about at that point kind of like moments where you, for lack of a better term, like we're pigging out.
Yes. And I think for me, and it doesn't ruin the book, I think, you know, I lost both my parents mm-hmm. by the time I was 15. Mm-hmm. And the reason I put that in, Andrew, is because I think what happens to you before you start a business mm-hmm. affects the way you run the business, affects the way you feel about the business. So for me...
What do you mean by that, though?
Well, so my family was basically destroyed, right? After my father died when I was 12, my mother died when I was 15. So
there was a lot of dysfunction around this. You guys yes. didn't talk about it very
right.
much.
I didn't have a home.
Yep.
I was...
There was a stepdad you
yes,
weren't particularly
a stepdad
fond of.
I hated. Yep. I was adopted by my oldest brother who had mm-hmm. left the house by the time I was 7. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of... there was a lot of how do you move forward, Ed? And it's like you just put one leg in front of the other. Mm-hmm. And you develop resilience that you don't even know you possess mm. because you're a teenager, right? Who knows about resilience, mm-hmm. right? And so for me, it was I found, and I don't think this was necessarily a great thing to learn, that I could take a punch. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think when you start a business, particularly one that has no model, no, mm-hmm. no preordained game plan to follow yeah. or roadmap, you're making it up as you go along. You need that resilience, you know, and sort of one of the themes of the book.
Yeah.
And again, this doesn't ruin it for people is. How many times I had to call upon that resilience.
We were in the hallway before we came into this conference yeah. room, and you said to me, you said that, you know, you've had some communication with people who've read the book and or have asked you about it, and they're like, is it a food book? Is it a business book? Is it a whatever? Right? And you don't love that question. But I have to tell you, I was going to ask you a related question,
sure.
which is, I was reading this book, and I'm like, you know, I've always thought of you as a food writer who was very tenacious. You developed this site. It was like, you know, the fifth or sixth chapter of your life. You were in the music business. You were in marketing, I guess what we would call branding, entertainment, yeah. all this stuff, right? But, you know, I think at heart, you're actually an entrepreneur.
Yes.
And I was going to ask you which you more consider yourself.
Yeah.
Which I'm not asking you to classify the book, but you're smiling huge as I say this.
It's
but
funny.
For as much as you're associated with like knowing the best pizza in New York and the best burger,
yes.
I think you're actually at heart, and you proved it in the, you know, ultimately in the long game, you're an entrepreneurship is a very particular gene.
Yes.
It takes a lot of entrepreneurs. Like you happen to love food, right? But you probably, if your life had gone just a slightly bit, like a sliding doors moment, gone a different way, you might have developed a blog or a website, whatever, about something totally different
yes.
and succeeded in this. That's most entrepreneurs can translate it to different things.
Yes, but here's the difference between me and a lot of entrepreneurs. So, you know, like Danny Meyer, you know, the great... he says, this is a hilarious and moving story of unconventional entrepreneurialism.
There you go.
And here's why I'm not a conventional entrepreneur. Because most conventional entrepreneurs, even though they would never admit this, what they really want to do is make a lot of money.
Yep.
It was never about the money. It was for me, yes, I wanted to provide some kind of financial security for my family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were both independent contractors. You know, mm-hmm. my wife's a successful literary agent, mm-hmm. but it's not as if we have, you know, 401ks mm-hmm. and pensions mm-hmm. coming from big corporations. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I wanted that, but I wanted to, it had to be something that I would do even if I wasn't getting paid. And most entrepreneurs wouldn't say that. Mark Zuckerberg would not say that.
Well, do you know the famous Jeff Bezos thing? Jeff Bezos, Amazon. Do you know why Amazon sold books initially? Because there was already, I forget what it's called, but there was already a system. It was like the electronic version of the Dewey Decimal System.
Right.
There was a system of ISBNs and all these codes sure. that they could just, you know, I don't even know the terms, but flow into their software. Right? There were two possibilities. I forget the other one. It was books and something else,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
He didn't care.
No,
he had
care.
This vision for an online retail business, right? And it could have been garden equipment.
Right.
He would have been fine.
A brilliant
yeah.
business genius
yes.
by any, you know, yeah. like many football fields
yes.
ahead of me as an
yeah.
entrepreneur. But I say in the book, you know, one of the problems with Serious Seats was I could never admit it. You know, I would say by the third year we're going to have $40 million in sales.
Yeah.
People tell me you had to say that
because
nobody – you couldn't say, I'd really like your money so I could have my dream job.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Nobody,
I just need enough to get by.
I just need enough to pay the rent and pay my site master.
Could
give
yeah.
me a couple of $100,000 so I could have my dream job?
Right.
It's so because that's not why people invest in.
Yeah.
Yes, they invest in people.
Yeah.
Especially this, right? When there was no model. There was no, you know, people had asked me for what they call comps in the business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, well, you know, I was lucky when I was building it. HuffPo was sold for a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were comps, but when I started seriously,
comps meaning comparative analysis.
Exactly.
Yeah. yeah.
And so people just invested because they were passionate about food. My friend Mark Lazary,
mm-hmm.
who is now the co-owner of the Milwaukee Bucks,
mm-hmm.
and we were basketball buddies
mm-hmm.
on 76th Street. This is well before he'd become so successful
yeah.
in business. And I went to him for advice, you know, and this was before he owned the Bucks.
Yeah.
And Mark, I'm really sorry they didn't get to the finals. I can say that on mic. But, I went to him for advice. We went out to Soup Burg on Madison
okay.
Avenue in 74th, where the soup isn't so good, but the burgers, the griddle burgers are pretty good. And he said to me, he said, you know, I think I'll invest in this. Look, I don't, as you know, I don't give a shit about food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I know the esteem in which you're held by the people in your world.
Mm-hmm.
And that really gave me some insight as to why people invest in things that – this is like – Serious Eats was the equivalent of a Broadway play.
Mm.
Or an off-Broadway play,
mm-hmm.
right? It was on the face of it. Patently absurd. Now, I could rationalize it in the business plan and explain how all
yeah.
the advertising money was migrating to online and this great Richard Parsons
mm-hmm.
quote that, you know, blogs are the magazines of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
None of them turned out to be true, but it doesn't matter. The point is, oh, it's Richard Parsons. He knows what he's talking about.
Right.
You just want to give people permission to write the check.
Mm-hmm.
And so – but there were so many things I was terrible at, Andrew. One of the things was I didn't realize, and many people have told me this subsequent to my selling, it's like it takes as much energy and time to raise $100,000 as it does a couple of million.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always never raising money. There wasn't one moment. I think there wasn't one 90-day period where I was not out looking for
mm-hmm.
money.
Yeah, you say that
and
in the book.
And it really yeah. wears you down,
mm-hmm.
going out and looking for money. Because also after a while, your initial investors are like, I'm tapped out. Even Mark Lazary, and I say this in the book, you know, like at the end, he's like,
nope. Right.
You know, it's like, I have a number in my head that
yes.
I invest in things like this. And it has nothing to do with how much money people have.
Yeah, you say in the
right.
book that even if someone has seemingly unlimited money, that has nothing to do with how much they're willing to keep throwing into your
exactly.
venture.
It's
yeah.
100%
true. And I'm sure
true.
You know, chefs and restaurateurs listening to this have experienced the same thing.
Absolutely.
They have investors who could probably write a check for the whole project.
Right.
But they come in for like $15,000 or
exactly.
$50,000 or $100,000.
And I've talked about this with many restaurateurs and chefs that you you've had on
your show.
Because
it's the same psychology, right?
It's the same psychology. I remember Tom Colicchio once told me that one of the best lessons he learned from, I think it was from Kraft, from the first Kraft, was he had a lot of investors. And that meant he had a lot of people that were calling him for tables giving him advice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's why people look for one
whale,
investor.
What they call a whale. Some people call a whale. Yeah.
And again, it's all hard, right? A restaurant is super hard to make work. A website is super hard to make work because in my case, here's the thing. And I say, talk about this in the book. When I started Serious Eats in December of 2006, and I looked at my competitive framework, I didn't have Amazon. I didn't have Facebook. Facebook, the first year they sold advertising, I say this in the book, I think they sold $474,000 in 2004 or 2003. Mm-hmm. By the time I was selling Serious Eats in 2014, I believe they were up to $14 billion.
Well, I don't even know if you'll remember this, but I had lunch with you once, and I wanted to talk to you about my little blog, which in hindsight, you know, I'd look at a book like this, and I go, and I should say, I look at a story like yours is told in this book, and I go, I was never going to do that. That's not me. I'm not cut out for that. I'm not cut out for what, you know, this like, you know, pounding the virtual pavement.
Yes.
For like over a decade. That's what you did.
Yes.
And I respect the hell out of it. My late grandfather started as a salesman and eventually owned a dressmaking company, right?
Sure.
He was that kind of guy. Yeah. I'm not that guy. I didn't realize that's what it took basically for any business venture. But what I was going to say was, you and I had lunch, and I was like, well, you know, do you think I could get advertisers for my blog? And you basically, this is maybe 5 years ago, you said, that ship has sailed. You're too late in the game. You're too small. You would need so many hits per month, and it was like in the millions, right?
Yeah.
And you would just, I don't want to say what it was, but you had just made a big deal for Serious Eats.
Yeah, exactly.
And you told me how many hits you had and what the month, and my head was spinning.
Yeah. At that point, we probably had, you know, 8 or 9 million unique visitors. And
Okay, so I guess I can say you had just hit a milestone of 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, monthly, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But think about that and then compare it to the scale and targeting through the data they acquire that Facebook has to offer.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, I only want to talk to food writers who have written books for major public. Oh, we can do that.
Yeah.
We can.
You mean Facebook can do that?
Yeah. Facebook could do that.
Yep.
Or, you know, and
you mean if you go on and run an ad or well, I've done that when I do like live shows. For a couple bucks, you go on and you can select zip codes, you can select age groups, you can select professions.
Because they collected data.
Yes.
And whether you knew they were collecting it didn't really matter because Facebook was collecting so much data that was invaluable.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the political stuff that's going on with Facebook.
Sure.
It's just that, you know, and now people I know that have successful online businesses, you know, my friend Omar at Meason makes really good knives and pans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those guys, they were used to just mining Facebook to find customers and to harvest sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they keep on testing different lists.
Mm-hmm.
And what my friends now tell me is they've realized that Facebook in the end is not all that interested in making other businesses successful.
Mm,
you know,
interesting.
That in the end, what Facebook wants to do is crush you like a bug at some point, right? Even the New York Times found that out, right?
Because
remember when Facebook was giving $5 million to a bunch of different established media vehicles to produce content that would live on Facebook with the idea that people will click to get outside Facebook. Well, it didn't really happen. So what the Times realized, it's kind of fool's gold. $5 million is not going to save our business, right? Time's a huge business. Mm-hmm. And so nobody does that deal anymore. Mm. And it's a fascinating thing, you know? And,
yeah.
And we all use, and SiriusXM still uses Facebook, and we still use Google, and mm-hmm. we still use Amazon. But I think what everyone realizes is you should never labor under the misapprehension that those businesses exist so they can help you build your business. Right. They may incidentally.
Yes, right. You may be able to use
temporarily.
Them.
Temporarily. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, sure. That's business.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, that's what the term that's business was invented for, right? You that know, kind of a construct.
My publisher commissioned this NYU professor, I forgot his name, wrote a book called The Four, which was the four companies that basically dominate our lives right now. Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this really simple, wonderful way to say, Facebook connects us all. Amazon allows us to buy anything we want whenever we want it.
Without leaving your house.
Exactly.
Or from Google, wherever you happen to be.
Google gives you answers to any question you might have.
Mm-hmm.
Apple makes you feel cool.
That was how they defined Apple. That's interesting.
It was fascinating. It's mm-hmm. a really good book. I forgot he also has a really good blog and podcast. I've got the guy's name.
Interesting.
He's an NYU
But that Apple
school
one's
professor.
A curveball.
Yeah.
Because Apple actually does, of all of them, you know, it's a phone, it's your communication device, it's your tricorder from Star Trek.
Basically, for sure.
But with music added.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have music on the tricorders.
Yeah.
That was just to get beamed up from wherever you were.
Yeah. You know, but there is that aspect to Apple, which is you do feel like you're a member of a tribe.
Oh, sure. Well, remember when Steve Jobs died and people were like going to the Apple stores?
Yeah. And laying
it was like a religious figure had died.
It was fascinating.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
So, Ed, you know, when we first started talking just now, you said something about a company being, you know, a product of your life to some extent. Now, what I thought you were going to, there were a couple of moments in the book early on, your story, you know, there's some of this family dysfunction. You know, I remember the one or two times I was one of the tasters for a white chocolate tasting once. At the offices, which were basically in like an apartment, a multi room apartment.
Yeah,
that to me, and reading this book and thinking about the warm vibe of that setting, to me that felt very much in some ways like, I'm not saying you don't love people in your family, but that felt very much to me like a surrogate family situation.
It totally did. You know, That's
like I felt like you created what you didn't have in your own home as a kid, and you were like the dad there.
It absolutely did. It absolutely did, because that was, my family was destroyed, right, when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And so SiriusXM was very much an attempt to create a new family. Mm-hmm. And by the way, which is not necessarily the best way to run a business. It is the best way to build a tribe, but it's not the best way to run a business. You
mean because if you have to make a difficult decision, if someone needs to be disciplined.
Yeah, your judgment is clouded.
And it makes it harder to do things even if you have clear judgment.
Yes,
but I remember you didn't even, at least in the iteration that I came to visit, you know, you, the creator of this, you know, food icon at this point, this site, you were at an open desk.
Yeah.
You didn't have an executive office or the equivalent. You didn't take one of the bedrooms in that residential space.
No.
You were sitting, there was someone like 2 feet from you.
Yeah, and that was the whole thing. My whole thing was I hated working for other people. I was really bad at it. I think I talk about this in the book. You know, I once tried to list every job I have ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to 100, I had to quit, you know, because, and some of them were short-lived, and many were contract jobs. But, you know, and I hated working for other people. I didn't suffer fools well. I have the worst, as my son will tell you, who has a great poker face.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's really good at the movie business, you know. I have the worst poker face in the universe.
You don't have a poker face.
I don't have. I do not have a poker face.
You and I were standing in the hallway waiting for Alyssa to come walk us to this room. And I don't know how many people you were like going off on because they had pissed you off.
Yeah,
that's all I'm going to say about that.
Exactly, but it's so
you don't have a filter.
Yeah, but what I do have.
But can I just before we lose this moment?
Sure.
What you just said about working for other people. But this is what I mean about this being like both the things that were in your life and weren't in your life, because you do say early in the book, this was a revelation to me about you. Your dad told you it sucks. I don't know what the exact language.
He actually he worked for my uncle and he hated it.
Oh, he never explicitly
said it.
But you say that it was, you make it clear that that was a message from him to you that it stinks to work for other people.
Right.
Yeah,
and so
that really affected you.
It totally affected me. That was like a
North Star for you.
Yes, and I didn't know it. And so when I worked for other people, what really bothered me, and you probably haven't spent a lot of time working for other people, you know, probably off and on. Yeah,
well, I mean, for the first X years of my life, and I did.
I remember.
And then collaborating in some ways, working for people. Yeah. But I haven't had a job in forever.
But I hated my jobs because I felt there were 90% about the politics and the bullshit and 10% about the work.
Yeah.
And I created Serious Eats with the idea that I could reverse the ratios, that it would be 10% about bullshit and 90% about the work. And if I succeeded in creating that kind of place, then I would attract really smart and talented young people, because that's all I could afford, and I turned out to be right. And so,
how close did you come to that ratio?
You know,
like, did you learn it was harder than you thought it might have been?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, what do you think? What if you had to estimate? What do you think the ratio of bullshit to work ended, or ended up being?
I think it never got more than 20%, because politics it doesn't mean there wasn't 20% or 30% or 40% or 50% hard times. But
that's a different thing.
Yes, I tried really hard. Kenji talks about this. He talks about my lack of a poker face, you know, in the forward.
Yeah.
He goes, you know, he tried to hide from us all the business ups and downs.
The toll it took on you.
Right, but he was terrible
at it. Right, it was plain as day. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, but that's different. You know, there was some politics, because there always is politics when as soon as you have three smart people working for you instead of one, you're going to have politics.
And it can be with the best of intentions.
Exactly.
You can have three people who passionately believe this is the way to deal with this problem.
Exactly.
And it's all with the best interests of the company at heart. And they're all convinced the other people are out of their minds not to agree with that.
But there were so many times, this is one of the greatest things that I discovered with Serious Eats, that the 25-year-olds that I hired, it's much like my son now, who's 30. It's like, holy shit. Like, they were right. You know, it's like, there was at one point we were going to curate all the food for the Great Googa Mooga.
Okay.
I talk about this in the book, right? Those are the guys who started Bonnaroo.
Mm-hmm.
And they're super smart, super passionate about food. They decided food was going to be the next frontier.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit it off because, you know, as I talk about in the book and as you and I have talked about, you know, I spent a long time in the music business.
Yeah.
And so they were going to buy us and I was going to head up the music division, and that ended up falling through, like so many deals. And then they were like, okay, well, at least curate this food festival we're doing in Brooklyn. And so I started introducing them the same way you would. Like, you could have done the same job, right? So I started introducing the chefs that were into music.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
You know, the Frankies and Andrew Comellini. And and then we're having a staff meeting, and this woman, Carrie Jones, who's now a really good cocktails writer, says, can you tell me why we're doing this? I said, well, you know, it's going to be a big thing. And and she looks at me and she says, look, we really need you here. We already have a business. And you're spending all your time chasing chefs and purveyors for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
it's going to be a shit show in all likelihood. And we just don't think you should do it.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, maybe they're right. And so I decided not to do it, mm-hmm. right? And then I had to go over to Jonathan's office, which is on LaGuardia Place, one of the founders of Bonnaroo. A really good guy, mm-hmm. super smart guy. And he was so pissed at me because I hadn't signed a contract. But right.
Yeah, you had a handshake. You had
exactly. And he was so mad at me. But they were right, right?
Your team was right.
Yes.
Yeah. And that thing ended up.
Yeah, it was a shit show.
Did it even have a second
year? It had a second year, but it barely.
Yeah, and there was bad weather, and it was
bad
like
weather, the crowd control was terrible. Exactly. Yeah, everything was terrible.
It was a disaster. I didn't go, but it was. I remember Grub Street reporting in detail.
Yeah, yeah. Every headline had shit show in it.
Yeah, it was bad. But, you know, this gets to something else, though. This was like this alternate light you talk about in the book. Your time in the music industry. You like the idea of being like a promoter.
I love putting on a show. I love putting on.
There is a part of you that would have been very happy being a producer of some kind.
Absolutely, and I did work for a concert production company, and I love those shows. I love putting tickets on sale and doing radio spots. For music that I love.
Yes.
So if it's Sonny Rollins or Miles Davis or B.B. King or Al Green, or I think a peak moment for me was when we had a show of Ray Charles and the Staple Singers at Carnegie Hall, mm-hmm. and they practically levitated the joint. And, mm-hmm. you know, we were sort of the offbeat promoters in New York. This was at a time when every city, it was like mafia territories, every city had one promoter. So it was Ron Delsener in New York. For years and years. Every concert ticket you ever got. If you were Andrew Friedman, it's like, and you could say to the agent that represented Elton John, I'll pay you twice as much money as Ron. Sorry. Ron has it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was all we could do to put together these super creative shows, but I loved it. But I saw how marginal it was, and that no one's been able to make that niche work.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ran a jazz club, and I loved that. And I talk about, you know, like Max Gordon from the Village Vanguard called me up, I think when he was fighting with his wife, Lorraine. Yeah. It's like, I want to talk to you about maybe taking over the Vanguard. And it's like, wow, this is the coolest phone call ever. So I met with him. And then, of course, he and Lorraine made up. And Lorraine ended up running it beautifully for years and years.
Yeah.
And I love, you're right, I love, but more than anything in the world, I love being a missionary for things that I believe in.
Mm.
You know, that's why when Ruth Reichel called me the missionary of the delicious, she totally nailed it. Because
had she heard you use that word?
No.
Okay.
She really got you. We went on a New York.
There's a funny line in the book. She says, she gets you to take her on a tour of some of the best eats in New York. And she said, it was too much to do in one day. And then you parenthetically say, it was only 10 places, right. Which like you're kind of out food writering the food writer.
Exactly.
Yeah. So like 10 places, even for me, I'm like, if I was in
a lot of places.
It's no. I mean, but I could do it in a day.
Yeah.
Like if I was writing a piece.
And she was game. She did it. You know, I think we made it to 10 that day.
Oh, you did it in one day.
I can't remember.
Oh, I read it as you guys split it into 2 days.
No, we didn't. She did it in one day.
So she was saying it was enough for two days. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So
she's a trooper.
Yeah, she's a total trooper, and she totally got me.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, like someone once came up to me, and I don't think I put this in the book, this woman who'd gone to Grinnell with me, and I was doing an event at Fairway to promote one of the New York Eats books.
Okay.
This woman came up to me, and she said, you know, you do the same thing in food now that you used to do in music at Grinnell. And I said, what do you mean, Carol? She said, you tell us what the good stuff is and why we should care about it. Mm-hmm. And it's true. You know, it was like, I've sort of been fortunate enough to spend most of my work life doing that.
And
whether
that
it's in music
on.
Or I love that.
Yeah, as you're I have to say, as you're saying all of this, I'm not going to say like you're grinning broadly or you're not really, but there is a, your eyes have lit up.
Yeah.
And there's just, your energy has shifted.
Yeah, and yeah. I love that
You're
stuff.
You're like glowing as you talk about
Yeah, that's this. Why in the book it's like, well, if I just bring these guys bagels from Absolute, you know, they're going to give me a big check.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
it does get to be hilarious at some point. Yeah. Because it's every single meeting is you're taking people to some – and not fancy pants.
No.
It's not Jean George or
– No.
It's you're taking them to like a Turkish restaurant or a burger joint or
– for sure.
Or bringing donuts to their office or whatever it is.
Yeah, and somehow I thought – I convinced myself that that was going to get me over.
What else were you going to do other than go somewhere and eat? Like, that's how you would do a business meeting.
I was never going to get money for my for how good my Excel spreadsheets were.
Right.
It's just never going to happen.
Right.
You know, it's like...
In the book, you describe over and over and over and over. I don't know that you ever call attention to it as a running thing, right? But I'm curious to know how you went about doing this, because they can't all have been people that you knew, right? You are constantly sitting down. I think it's an interesting lesson for people. You constantly sit down with other food writers, entrepreneurs, business people, tech people, and talk shop, right? And you were getting valuable information from these people.
Absolutely.
So how did, let's put aside the people you just happened to know or go to college with or whatever, right? Would you ring up or email total strangers and say, can we get a bite?
Was it
how did it happen? Because you did a lot. I mean, I lost count, but you're constantly in passing. You're like, and then I was having lunch with so-and-so and they told me about blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God.
This happens to you. It's like when you're telling somebody you know about what you're doing, if you tell it in a way that reveals your passion and your enthusiasm, people want to connect you as a result. And so that's what would happen to me. You know, it's like, so one of the original partners in Serious Eats who ended up not being a partner, you know, said to me, oh, you should meet Meg Hourihan. She founded the company that created the first blogging software and sold it to Google. And now she has a food blog. Okay. So I went out and Meg and I hit it off. We're totally different people, incredibly smart, tense woman who could write code and write English, which is a rare combination. Maybe not. But... And then I went over to Meg's house for a party when Internet Week was happening. I think this was in 2005 or 2006. And I just found myself in this room full of Web 2.0 pioneers. Like, here's the Dennis Crowley. He founded Foursquare. Here's Nick Denton. He's the founder of Gawker. Right. And I talk about this in the book. In 2006, it wasn't a Darwinian struggle. It was a collective effort. We were all spreading the gospel of the blogosphere.
Okay.
And so they weren't like paranoid. None of them had food blogs. They were like, hey, have you thought of this? Hey, have you thought of this? Have you thought of this? And all of a sudden, I was like, this is like the blogging equivalent of Davos. You know, it's like I've just wandered into this party and people are offering help and wanting to have lunch with me.
Yeah.
And so it just sort of happened organically. And again, I think partly because it was a moment in time. Like that wouldn't happen in 2000. I don't think it would happen in 2019. Mm-hmm. I think it's too hard. The air doesn't seem quite so pregnant with possibility. In 2006,
right,
the air seemed pregnant with possibility, like anything could happen.
So this is like, I think you and I have talked about this. There's a book I love. It was kind of the role model for my book. There's a book called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls,
right,
about the American film directors of the 70s.
Peter Biskin.
And it's about like when Spielberg and Coppola and Lucas and people that probably aren't as well known to most people,
and that Bogdanovich, was a moment in time.
But they were all hanging out in Malibu Beach. They were all making movies. They would all as a thing. Like somebody would give one of them would give the other one like a little idea, and they go, "I'm going to give you a point."
right.
of the profit,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
And they were all buddies.
It was all worth nothing to them.
And there so were like, ten, but there were also like 10 of them.
Yes.
If you talk to somebody like Ruth Reichel about the early days of food writing, she'll go like, "There were like 10 of us."
Exactly, and it was this, it was exactly
so that
the
wasn't
same
there was
thing.
It was all open, as they say in like about
right.
Vegas,
now,
right?
It's funny,
it was open. It
yes.
was like there was endless possibility, endless opportunity. Not everybody wasn't fighting for the same scraps.
Exactly, and now it's a yeah. zero sum game,
right?
And so, oh, I can't share with you information like that. You know, because maybe I'll make less money.
Like, right.
You know, and it wasn't like that. And I was very
So you
fortunate.
All were trying to help each other.
Yeah, we all were trying to I flew home from that party because I was like, this is the coolest group of people, and they did save me. And I talk about, you know, when I surrounded myself with what I call Team Serious Eats, and then mm-hmm. I won't spoil it, but those people didn't do right by me. And mm-hmm. then I discovered my tribe, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm a huge fan of the book called Tribe. I don't know if you've ever
no.
read it, but it's a great book by Seth Godin, who's
oh,
sort of
sure.
this marketing
yeah.
guru.
Yeah, yeah.
Unbelievably smart and actually the publisher of Portfolio publishes Seth, or sometimes okay. he self-publishes. But and so I was able to have lunch with Seth. So
wow.
Adrian said, oh, have lunch with Seth. This is when I was writing the book. And, you know, he gave me some advice, and some of which I followed and some of which I didn't. But what I said to him was, you know, Adrian gave me your book. I said, you would have saved me a lot of pain if I would have read the book. At earlier, because by the way, I recommend the book. I couldn't recommend any book more highly. When people ask me what business book should I read. First of all, I don't read that many business books, but Tribes, which is really like 155 pages, you mm-hmm. can read it on a plane to Boston.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's awesome.
But I have to say you would have saved your time, but don't you feel that? First of all, the triumph, ultimate triumph, was that much sweeter
mm-hmm.
for the struggle. And also, I always say the best way to learn your way around an area is to get lost in it, right?
Yes.
And I think the same is true of the best way to learn your way around a new business. The
Absolutely.
Is, right? So,
by the way, it's,
so
our,
it's you probably
it was my reporter's chops, really.
That too.
Yeah.
But you probably were the wiser and more fluent in all kinds of things about your business for not having read that book.
Absolutely.
Right? Because you had to gain that knowledge yourself through trial and error and hard knocks.
Yes.
And, right?
And the fact that I made it out the other side,
yeah.
you know, I don't want to ruin it for everybody, but although people say, I even know what happened and I still was
yes.
anxious for you.
Well, you describe, what do you say, toward like the, was it a year or 6 months where you didn't sleep through the night once?
Yeah, it was
and that's like in the,
crazy.
I mean,
and also, you
that's
know.
That's in the home stretch of the story.
And
your wife, and by the way, nor did your wife.
No, and my wife, yeah. who is the hero of the book for many reasons.
Yeah.
Number one, and I say this in the book, you know, the only way a small business person can borrow money is to personally guarantee it,
mm-hmm.
right? So I basically put up our apartment by the time, not all of it, but
yeah.
a big chunk of it.
Yep.
And she hated this, right? She hated the idea that I was doing that. So for that reason alone, she's also an incredibly good business person. She has a very successful literary agency. There's also something else, you know, that I talk about in the book, which is she has a different tolerance for risk than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that, my tolerance for risk has to do with, again, what happened to me when I was growing up.
Yeah.
She, and I say, when you fall in love, nobody asks you, that's not one of the questions you discuss.
Right? Yeah.
What's your tolerance for risk?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so in a way, she does have it, but she doesn't want to admit it. And I just pushed it because I thought if Sirius Eats died, I would die. That's how...
Literally?
Yeah, that's how identified I was with the business. I don't know about literally, but like I...
That's how much it meant to you. That's how much you had poured into it.
I couldn't imagine a world without Serious Eats.
Because of the vision, because of how much you had put into it, because of the people who...
All of the above.
Who came to work for you. Yes. All of that.
All of the above. Yeah.
That was your world.
That was my world.
Yeah.
And I created this world... And I loved it so much, except when we were about to go out of business, which was almost all the time.
Yeah.
But I couldn't separate myself. And, you know, and the other reason that my wife is a hero of the book, because she even let me write this book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife's an extremely private person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more of a...
open book, no pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the fact that she gave her blessing, you know, to me writing this book is quite something, you know. And I...
Why do you think she did? I mean, you didn't need to write the book.
No.
You did the company.
Yeah.
You lived it. You didn't need to write it. You lived it. So why do you think it was that important to you to do it?
You know, it's a great question. I think, you know, all of us writers... I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.
And I recognized that on some level I wanted to tell my story because
mm-hmm.
I thought it was a pretty good story.
Yeah.
And I thought people would benefit, people who are thinking about starting their own business or just people who want to get an intimate look of what it's like to do something you're passionate about all the time, and you know how hard it is. It's not that it's a cautionary tale, but I think it's also kind of a celebration. I think it's sort of part cautionary tale and part celebration. You know,
I wouldn't describe it as a cautionary tale.
Oh, good.
I would describe it as a what it takes tale.
Yeah, it is a what it takes.
What does it take?
Yes,
you want to be successful. You want to score big. You want to like. Yes, there are people who do it, hit the jackpot young and early, right? And
right.
That happens.
Yes.
That happens. Most people who make a killing, do well, build something and sell it, more often than not, it is like your story, which is an ulcerative
exactly.
existence for a long time,
yes.
A lot of intestinal fortitude, a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of, what does Fitzgerald call it, 3 a.m. of the soul, right? Like a lot of, that's the place where you're going to live.
Absolutely.
That's most people.
And I talk about this at the end. You know, it's like you also have to define success for yourself, right? Because the money I made from Serious Eats isn't even walking around money for some Silicon Valley billionaire.
Sure. Yeah.
It's not. But for me, it was enough.
Yeah.
And I was thrilled.
Yes.
My investors had long since kissed their money goodbye to return like 90% of their money in cash.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also have stock in the new company and the company that bought us. And, you know, we made some money that feathered our retirement. And I created something that provides pleasure to millions of people. And I'm really proud of all the people. And this is the last thing, and it is totally unexpected, the pleasure of giving all these people their sea legs, and I know I'm mixing metaphors, and watching them take flight.
The people who work for you.
Yes. Yeah. I love that people would say to me, well, you know, are you jealous of Kenji's success? No. Like, when Kenji had a success with his Food Lab book, it was like my son was bar mitzvahed. You know, it was like, I love that. I wanted to put a page where all the books that Serious Eats editors have written, you know,
but he's also, I don't know Kenji. I don't even think I've ever met him.
Oh,
weirdly.
Really?
Yeah, weirdly. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can tell from what he wrote about you or up front, you know, he showed up and put some recipes in the book for you. You know, he continued being part of Serious Eats. You know, my dad, my late father used to say, opposites attract, but similar values attract.
Absolutely.
And you guys are both I can tell. I know you pretty well. I mean, for someone I haven't spent that much time with, I feel like I really know you.
Yeah.
But I could tell from the way you guys talk about each other, from the way he is spoken of by people I know who do know him. You guys, you know, like different generations, different cultural backgrounds, blah, 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 blah. But he's more scientific than you are, obviously. But
and a much better cook.
You guys conduct yourselves in a similar manner.
Absolutely. And you know, he
That's the bond, right?
Yes, that's the bond.
Yeah.
You hit the nail on the head. That's the bond that bonds me to everybody who's worked for the site.
Mm-hmm.
We shared values, you know, and to me that's the most important thing in a business or a marriage or anything else. It's like if you share values, and that's you it's interesting that you recognize that, because it's totally true about Kenji. We also shared some voice similarities in our writing style.
You mean specifically the two of you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know, he talks about in the book when he, you know, when I say, okay, I'll pay you $30 a recipe to start, you know, and he goes, why am I agreeing to do this? Why do I believe this guy? You know, and yet he decides to go on the adventure with me,
mm-hmm.
you know, why? Because as you say, I think he recognized a kindred spirit.
Yeah.
Look, you're right. I don't have the scientific mind. I don't have the cooking chops. But when it came to values, what mattered to us?
Right.
And that's the bond we have. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some other things too.
Sure.
And what's interesting is as the years go by, I feel in a way we've gotten closer, you know, because he's had so much success on his own, which is awesome. And all these people, Max Falkowitz and Carrie Jones and Maggie Hoffman, all these people have written books and are doing really well. That just makes me so happy, which was the most unexpected pleasure that I got from Serious Eats.
But whether or not you were once their boss or colleague, whatever, don't you think it's fucked up for anyone who feels otherwise?
Yes.
Like, So I was in the film business in my early 20s. That was my dream as a kid.
Right.
I wanted to be a screenwriter and producer. I came really close.
Right.
And this is what I mean about me. I read this book and it's like, you know, and I do have this thought sometimes. Well, maybe if I'd stuck around, written another few spec scripts, because my writing partner and I came really close, maybe I would have done it. But I didn't have the stomach for that. I wanted more security.
Right.
Said me as a freelance writer, but that was a whole other thing.
Right.
So you know, but I have friends who are showrunners on sitcoms. People I was an assistant with when I was 22. I just had lunch with two of them actually in L.A. when I was out for the L.A. Chess Conference. Yeah, an old friend of mine was on the Goldbergs, and now he's on the spinoff called Schooled.
Great.
And a guy who had been an assistant to a producer, and I when he left to go write for the Golden Girls, I took his job. I moved into his job, right? And the three of us, this is 20-something years later, had lunch the other day. And friends of mine have said to me, like, are you jealous? Is it hard for you to see those guys? And I'm like, that would be really weird.
Right.
Like, I love those guys.
Yeah.
Like, I'm happy for them.
Yeah.
And if I wanted it badly enough, I would have stuck around.
Exactly.
It's not like I think I wasn't good enough. I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't hit it right. My scripts didn't get to the right people. I wasn't tenacious enough.
Look, it's.
But I think it's weird when people aren't happy for their. There was an old joke years ago in the 80s. There was a line. It's really dating myself. It's not enough for me to succeed. My friends have to fail. Right?
And
you've heard that line.
Yeah.
I never understood that.
No, it's the greatest thing in the world when I watch all of these people take flight. Even to this day, the people that work at Serious Eats, you know, I feel that way about. It's not even my company anymore.
Right.
You know, but I still feel that way about it. And you know, it's interesting what you say, because I think what you didn't have.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I don't even know if it was perseverance. You didn't have a little bit of luck.
Well, that's part of it.
You know, I say I say in the book, you know, one of the dedications is for the Sirius Eats tribe at World Headquarters and our community million strong who taught me anything and everything is possible with the aid of hard work, a good idea, and a little luck.
A little luck? Well, you know, you and I are both tennis fans.
Right.
Sorry, listeners, who once again have to hear a tennis analogy.
Right.
Almost once every Grand Slam when he is commentating, someone will have a point in a match. And it'll be a champion. It'll be like a Nadal or a Federer.
Right.
And John McEnroe will at some inevitably during a Grand Slam say, well, if you want to win Grand Slams, you can be talent. You can be talented. You can be this. You can be that. There's always a moment of luck.
Right.
There's always a moment
exactly.
of luck.
Exactly. And yes, do people make their own luck? When Kawhi Leonard hit that shot that bounced around the rim four times.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know. There was some luck involved.
Right. But he also took the shot.
He also took the shot.
Yeah.
And he's one of the two or three best basketball players on the planet.
Yeah.
So who knows where skill ended and luck started on that shot.
So here's one thing I need to ask you. Maybe the last thing I'll ask you today. But so, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time. Not well.
Right.
I think the first time we had lunch was maybe 5-6 years ago. We went to that place, that little Israeli-ish place near your office. I don't know what the food was.
Oh, yeah.
I had a shashuska, and you... Yeah, yeah. What was that called?
Taim. Not Taim. No. It was Balabusta.
Balabusta.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I came by the office.
Einat Admini's restaurant.
Yes, we went and had lunch. I think that was the first time you and I had ever sat down
together. I think that's true.
Okay. But I would see you around parties, events.
Right.
You were always super friendly. You always seemed happy, right? Then I read the book, okay? And now I have this overlay. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, when I saw him at the Food & Wine Best New Chefs party that year, like, that was probably one of those times where he was having sleepless nights, you know?
Exactly.
Or when I called him and said, can we have lunch? Can I have advice? And I came by the office, and you seemed like the happy papa of the office.
Right.
And, you know, we went to lunch, and you patiently listened to my questions and gave me advice and all that. You know, I had no clue of the roller coaster you were on.
Yeah.
So... was it like, so here's my question. Throughout this time, to maintain sanity, to maintain productivity, to not fall into a depression to me, depression is paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things.
For a writer,
if you're depressed, productivity shuts down.
And you can't, as a business person, you also can't make decisions.
Right. I think I think paralysis is a signifier of depression, right? So, but were you able to compartmentalize the roller coaster? Did you have to meditate? How did you be the Ed Levine that I experienced periodically over these years, right? And I think most people experienced also.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you maintain that public or maybe also private Ed Levine when you were on the roller coaster? What was it? What was the technique? What was the aspect of your personality?
Funny. I'm not even sure. I think it was an innate resilience, and I managed to hide a lot of the pain well enough. So the only people that heard it and experienced it were my wife and my really close friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my friend Bob Rosen, who's been my friend for nearly 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say once a month, Andrew, I would be watching a game that was my salve.
Mm-hmm. When you say a game?
Could be
whatever, baseball, basketball.
And I'd call Bob and I'd say, I just don't see it. You know, I keep going through the numbers and it's like, we're
looking into the abyss.
Yeah, we're out of business in a month. And he'd say, you know what?
So you would just be, sorry to interrupt, you would just be sitting there watching a game.
Yeah.
This thing would like swell up inside you.
And I couldn't control it. And
and
that's also part of why I wanted to talk about what happened to me when I was a kid, because there was a battle, constant battle going on inside me between thinking that things could work out and catastrophizing. Could be about the same moment.
Things could work out, for example, with the health of your dad with rheumatic fever and
exactly.
all that.
Or anything. Or with my brother when I went to live with him.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and so there was this constant, you know, there's that famous scene in Animal House when
The angel John and the devil. Belushi,
exactly. it was the same thing. And so
yeah.
I would catastrophize everything. I mean, I will tell you, and I talk about this in the book, you know, I was really lucky. I had a great, great psychotherapist
okay.
that really super helped.
All through this period?
Yeah, all through this period. I am one of the great advocates. My mother was a therapist, but that's not why. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I think a good therapist is just invaluable in anyone's life if you can afford it. And I think having a supportive wife really helped. You know, she'd be like, don't give up. You know, just don't. This is a good idea. Don't give up. Mm-hmm. You know, and my friends – like my friend Bob was like that. I was like, yeah, you'll figure it out. And even my brother, who is, as you know, a main character in the book.
Yeah.
He rest in peace. And,
yeah.
And I was thrilled that he was able to see Sirius Eats through to the end
yeah.
before he got sick. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even he could at times sort of rescue me from the abyss,
yeah.
from the emotional abyss.
Yeah.
It was a business abyss, but it may have been just a business problem that I would make into an abyss because I would catastrophize it.
Well, because you were so, you just said it was your world.
Yeah. Yeah,
right? I mean, it was inseparable. Yeah. I mean, that was your life.
So I just couldn't, so, you know, I think that's, so it's a combination of wiring, some luck, a great psychotherapist, a wonderful wife, and, you know, we all draw upon whoever and whatever we can, you know, to help get us through. And, you know, look, I consider myself the luckiest motherfucker on the planet. You know, I'm going to tell you that right now. You know, I know how close we were to going under, and I also know how good I feel now that we didn't, and watching all the Sirius Eaters just do great stuff, and watching the site continue to be sort of the gold standard, you know, for food websites. And so, and it's not, maybe a lot of people aren't trying to be the gold standard, but you know, it's like you do what you do because you have to think you do it as well or better than anybody else who does it. And that means, you know, that sometimes you're convincing yourself when it isn't true, right? I mean, it's true for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, there's always moments, you know, where you go, well, maybe I'm not the best person to write this book or, you know. But
well, or you have to be able to sometimes accept, this is very hard for me. As we sit here today, I have not posted my – now, normally my show would have gone up. We're here on a Wednesday. It was the Memorial Day weekend. I have to edit a show. My wife, who does the intros with me a lot, was away. I was having a moment of self-doubt, self-consciousness. I didn't want to record an intro alone. So my show's airing late this week. This will be in the past when this airs, okay? And honestly, the most healthy thing I could have done was get the damn show up yesterday.
Right.
And as Jimmy Bradley, my old podcasting partner, who used to have the Red Cat, used to say to me, once in a while we would have a show and I'd go, that wasn't that great. And I would be really tortured. Because Jimmy was primarily a chef. I'm primarily a media figure, right? And he says to me once, he goes, well, you know, you can get into the Hall of Fame hitting some balls and strikes also.
Right.
And I literally say that to myself sometimes.
Yeah.
Not everything you do, not if you're a writer, not every, I'm sure for chefs listening, right? Not every server, you're going to have an off service.
No.
You're going to have a day where you write an article and it's not Shakespeare.
I always say.
You can't always find that groove. It may be like a certain, you know, a certain article for me,
you have to
it's not the right vehicle for me to achieve my maximum success.
Exactly. And so
and you have to accept that.
I always said to myself through the Sirius Eats saga, I know I'm going to make mistakes. I just hope one of them isn't fatal.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
You have
because
to accept
if you,
that.
If you set your standards so high that you don't accept the fact that you're going to make mistakes, you're going to doom yourself to a really unhappy life.
Right. Or that's another way of becoming paralyzed.
Yeah.
You know, or unproductive.
Yeah, for sure.
Or unproductive. Okay, question. Are you free of the roller coaster?
Yeah. Well, it's
Do you ever have dreams about those days?
No.
You don't. You're really free of it.
I am.
There's a moment in the book where a check clears, right?
Yes.
That's the exhale moment.
Yes. Yes.
And that was for good. That was a moment in your life where you walked into the next
exactly.
phase.
For me, but
for you.
You know, as I wrote, it turned out that I had to make there were a lot of people who were still on edge, mostly from, you know, including my wife and my brother, just from what I had put them through. And then the serious eaters were upset because, like, their father had put them up for adoption, you know? And so I had to deal with that. But me, no. I was like, I couldn't believe it, Andrew. I was just like, did this just happen when, you know, there's that moment in the book.
Yeah. I mean, it's public. No, I mean,
So it's like...
It's like you said, someone wrote you and said, I know how it ends and I still love the book, right?
Right.
So I don't feel like we're ruining anything. Yeah, but you said what?
Yeah, I just said, you know, because my investment banker, Peter Cohn, is a lovely guy and a total mensch. I think he's at Barclays now. He said it's not over till the check clears. And so there's that moment in the book when my lawyer, also a wonderful human being named Andy Beam, who was part lawyer, part therapist, part financier or not, but he understood Excel much better than I did, but you know, where he said to me, he said, check your bank account. And so there is that moment in the book where I check my bank account and there's more money than I ever would have imagined would ever be in that bank account. And I would be like, holy fuck, we actually did it.
And what was the span of time from day one to that moment?
It was 9 years. and I hate roller coasters.
Okay, anyway. So let's get out of the book for 1 second.
Yeah, sure.
What's left for you? Is there unfinished business? Do you know?
What's
on the horizon for you?
Yeah, I mean,
what are you doing now?
You know, now it's funny because I actually loved writing this book for the first time, Andrew. I used to describe myself as someone who writes. And now with this book, I finally have accepted that I'm a writer and that I like that. And so I hope I'm going to continue to tell stories I want to tell. I have no desire to start another business. You know,
Nor do you want to retire.
No, nor do I want to retire. You know, there's a lot of things I want to do. I think Danny Meyer said something really interesting. He said, they'll reveal themselves to you on your book tour just through the questions people ask.
What you want to do next.
Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that's true, but, you know, I just feel that, you know, I don't have to obsess about what's next, which is really a lovely, lovely feeling.
Good for you.
Someone who lived with a fair amount of anxiety his whole life, to not have that particular kind of anxiety and stress is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
It's not to say that I won't be anxious about if you ask me this question in 6 months and I don't have a surefire answer for you, but it's different now and in the best possible way.
That's great. Well, I have to tell you, and I'm not just saying this, you know, you couldn't have said this about yourself, but you know, a lot of the questions I've asked you today, like, how were you able to sit down with these other people and, you know, why did this happen? Whatever, I don't want to embarrass you. I think you're a good guy. I barely know you. You've always been. I remember once years ago you had a question about some Tom Valenti recipe, and you wrote me, and then I was on Serious Eats, and you know you were like, Andrew Friedman's like hooking it up and like calling in, and I was like,
he can't be that grateful that I'm just like emailing a guy, you know? But I remember that.
Yeah.
When I sold my book and the news had broken, we talked about this before we started recording. You know, you came up to me at a party where 50 other people there, it was the Food and Wine Best New Chefs party. You were the only one who came up to me and said, congratulations.
Yeah.
Because, but that's you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, if there's such a thing as karma, or whatever, goodwill, karma, whatever you want to call it, I think that's maybe.
Yeah,
maybe it was that instead of luck.
One of the trade reviews said the last line of and it was a very positive review. I can't remember which trade it was. One of the publishing trades. He said, "This book proves that sometimes the good guys can win."
Yes,
you know.
And I would agree.
It doesn't mean that you're going to win.
Nope.
You know,
doesn't mean nice guys finish first.
Exactly.
I was going to say it proves nice guys do finish last, but they can win.
That's the other reason. You asked me why I wanted to write the book. It's like, this book is because only 0.1% of the businesses that are started end with a headline in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
The other 99.99% end up somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, right.
And I'm certainly incredibly proud of where Serious Eats has ended up.
Yeah.
But I just feel that if people read this, they'll understand what it's really like. It's not Facebook, it's not Amazon, it's not any of those things.
It's not the things you see in these documentaries, like the parties on the yachts and people spraying champagne.
No, it's
hard, lonely work. Exactly. Late at night, alone in an office or at your home, fearing the worst and still trying to push through.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm glad you got through to where you got.
Yeah, I'm thrilled.
I'm happy for you.
Thanks.
I'm thrilled for the book. Again, probably... You know, kind of a gift to the rest of us. You didn't need to write it. It's not like
thanks.
Anyway, it's Serious Eater with the great subtitle, I'm delighted to say, A Food Lover's Perilous Quest for Pizza and Redemption. It is just out. The author is Ed Levine, founder of Serious Eats and a good guy. You should all go read this book.
Thank you, Andy. Ed. This was really fun.
Thanks for being you and thanks for the book.
You're most welcome.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with two microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3555.
Are you enjoying our podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And together we host Why Food, a podcast about innovators, career changers, and entrepreneurs who are changing the face of food.
How did these folks decide to hit the brakes, start over, and become inspiring chefs, entrepreneurs, farmers, and activists they are today?
Browse episodes of Why Food wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to introduce you to the Jeremiah Tower tribute we did in just a moment. First of all, I do need to say the response that we received to the episode that aired last week, my old, recently sort of unearthed interview with Anthony Bourdain, was overwhelming. I don't know how many DMs I received. I don't know how many emails and texts I received from people who know me well enough to have that information, but man, I was absolutely moved by what you all shared with me. It was, you know, it was obviously a powerful week. It is interesting to me that I was afraid to air that interview. You know, I don't know how many of you out there, a lot of you who listen are cooks and chefs. Maybe you relate to more just saying the wrong thing in a tweet. But, you know, this digital era that we live in, I was really afraid I was going to drop that episode and people were going to say, you know, how dare you? Why are you airing this? I just didn't know. You know, feelings run passionately around Tony. And I didn't get one negative piece of mail. It's just an amazing moment. And I've made me feel very good to be able to share that with all of you. And for those of you who did take the time, I tried to write everybody back. But if I missed anybody, thank you for letting me know that I think I can safely say now we did the right thing very much. So I appreciate that. And I wanted to just tell you that. I am now going to introduce a tribute we did to Jeremiah Tower. The setup is this. I was in San Diego to do the Chef's Roll Anti-Convention. That was the first time they put on this event. I'm sure they're going to do another one next year. And Jeremiah Tower, who was the guest of honor, who, again, I'm sure everybody knows this by now. There was a movie about him a few years ago called The Last Magnificent, which actually Bourdain was the executive producer on and one of the interview subjects in the movie, as was I, actually. And, you know, just one of the legendary figures of American food and restaurants. Jeremiah was not just about what happened in the kitchens, which was transformative in his restaurants, but also changed what an American restaurant could be. You know, this thing we have in this country, the American Brasserie, in many ways can be traced back to his restaurant Stars, which opened in 1984. Prior to that, of course, he was at Chez Panisse. And in between, he had some restaurants that aren't as well remembered. Some of them come up in this interview and with his colleagues who I spoke to. So the setup is this. Jeremiah and I could not find a minute to interview. So we finally were heading to this tribute dinner these alums of Stars were going to do. And we interviewed in the back of the car. I wasn't trying to be Jerry Seinfeld. It was the only time we could get together and do this interview, literally, because we were both doing panel discussions and I was doing other interviews for the podcast and he was doing book signings. And so that's what we did. And then when their prep was done, I sat down with two groups of people who worked for Jeremiah back in the day, Mark Gehr and Clark Frazier, two chefs who are also partners in their personal life. They're up in Maine these days. They had a restaurant a lot of you will probably know of called Arrows. And we interviewed together, the three of us. And then I sat down with four people, Stephen and Jewel Vranian, who are now married. So actually, that's two couples that came out of that restaurant. But they're now married and in Minneapolis. Bruce Hill, who's a prolific chef and restaurateur in the San Francisco area. And Lisa Sheehan, who I had never met before, but who was a front of house person and manager at Stars. And those are the two groups. And I'm just going to let, I was spending weeks trying to cut these together in sort of, I think, an unnecessarily ambitious way. And I finally just decided to edit the individual interviews and just run them in sequence in three pieces. I think it's fine that way. And like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm trying to let go of this perfectionist streak a little because I've had this interview since April and it's a little ridiculous I haven't shared it with you. So with all of that, I'm now going to start with my interview with Jeremiah Tower. That will then flow into my interview with Mark and Clark, and then that will flow into the quartet of people I just described, and that'll be that. And I hope you learned something about Jeremiah. I think we did the interview a little differently. You'll see what I mean right off the bat. And with that, here you go. Okay, so we're in a car.
Yeah. You've interviewed in all kinds of places, but never in a car.
But we're going to... A dinner in your honor.
Yes, indeed.
As part of the Chef's Roll Anti-Convention.
Yes.
Okay, so I wanted to do this. I didn't tell you this before we spoke, but you're always up for anything. Can we do this a little differently? I feel like, I mean, I met you first in 2012, 7 years already.
Wow.
And certainly most of the interviews you and I have done have been 90% probably about the past.
Sure.
And the distant past.
Right.
You are very active right now. You're going to a lot of festivals. You're involved in a lot of things.
Right.
I think by now, between The Last Magnificent and the new edition of your book, Start the Fire, I think people who listen to this show who are mostly industry kind of know who the hell you are and what you've done.
Yeah, so no more introductions,
please.
Can we
just talk about the present
right
for you?
Let's do that.
Okay, so first of all, this week alone, you were here at the Chef's Roll anti-convention, they're calling it. You're the guest of honor.
Right.
You were on two panels today. There's a dinner in your honor tonight. You're going to another festival at the end of the week.
Don't forget the panel tomorrow.
You know, another panel tomorrow and book signings. Yeah. So, but what is your life like right now? How many, if you had to guess over the last 6 months, how many weeks do you think you were on the road?
Well, last year, I mean, we did one that was almost 60 days long, a tour, you know, of, not just for the film, but doing events and that kind of thing. So I'd say about 120 days a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what is the, do you, I mean, you've been at this a while.
Right.
Do you, you've taken breaks where you've kind of gone off on your own.
Gone to the beach.
Gone to the beach for years.
Right.
But do, how do you, I mean, do you enjoy it? Do you enjoy running around like this? Do you enjoy being back on the circuit as it was?
Yes. I mean, I'm like James Beard who said he was vaccinated with a passport, you know.
Okay.
Can't stop moving.
So right.
I love being motionless on the beach, but I also love being very involved in traveling and,
yeah.
and going to events.
Yeah. And what about meeting? I mean, it's funny. I was watching you today. There were chefs coming up to you and saying, you know, thank you. There were also a number of very young cooks yes. and chefs talking to you.
That's really surprising because a lot of them have seen The Last Magnificent. And I thought it would turn off young cooks.
But in what way?
They love the honesty of it, which is the main reason we did it, you know.
No, but how did you think it would turn them off?
Well, it's pretty raw, that film, you know. And also, I mean, the title's fairly embarrassing, The Last Magnificent. I'm saying I'm magnificent,
yeah, right.
and I'm the last one. I
mean, right.
Both of those are kind of wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Okay. But they, I mean, these people were, like, eager to meet you.
Yes.
What's that like? You know, there's a lot of, I think a lot of chefs who I personally admire a lot never lose their interest in youth and young cooks
right.
and young chefs. Paul Bocuse, I used to see him interact. I'm sorry. For those of you who think I name drop too much, I just don't know how else to say that. I used to see him interact with the competitors in the Bocuse d'Or.
Right.
You know, these people who would come to his 3-star Michelin restaurant in jeans and untucked shirts to, you know, for an audience with him.
Right.
He loved them. He loved seeing what they were doing. Norman Van Aken loved spending time with the young cooks who worked for him. You seem to have that same sort of appreciation for that.
Well, it's their energy also, and it's wonderful to be able to pass on things. All the things I've learned,
yes,
pass that on.
Yep.
But also, it's only interesting to pass it on because of their energy and their newness and their eager to learn. That's a real turn on. I mean, that's inspirational. For me, it was certainly, I'm sure, inspirational for Paul Bocuse.
Yeah. But you also seem to, you seem to have, I think it's very, I think it's a very natural thing. I'm now in my early 50s. I find myself fighting it all the time.
Right.
I said it on this panel we were on together today. You know, I really try to appreciate that, yes, things do change, but you just have to accept that.
Right.
Right? You can't turn into the grumpy curmudgeon saying how much better it used to be, even though maybe in some ways it was better, in some ways probably things were worse. But you seem to me, I've heard you talk about dining experiences in the last 5 years. You seem to me to have remained very open-minded to what's going on right now.
Because, I mean, that's what keeps one going. You know,
yes.
You read about these people who are 90. Not that I want to live to be 90. That's not the point. But they're the ones who, like Leah Chase in New Orleans, she's 92 or 3. She's still in the kitchen frying chicken.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and her mind, I mean, she's 92 years old, so the body is 92, but the brain
yes.
and the mind is of a young woman
yeah.
because she's still involved.
Is that a natural impulse for you, or is that something that you had to consciously develop as you've matured?
No, I mean, it wasn't conscious and isn't conscious at all, but when I, it only occurred to me like that when I saw Leia Chase at a convention at the Commander's Palace last year on a symposium panel.
Yeah.
And she was on stage in a wheelchair, and everyone was sort of a little bit hesitant waiting for her to talk. I mean, was she going to drool? Was she going to embarrass right. herself and us? No, absolutely, she was the most vibrant person on that stage.
Yeah. What? How about your cooking life these days? Do you, when you are home, are you cooking?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
What kind of? What,
go to the market every morning.
You do.
Yeah.
And what kind of things are you interested in doing? Do you kind of lean on your repertoire? Do you still sort? Do you still improvise? How do you cook these days?
I never know what I'm going to cook until I see what's
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
So I mean, that sounds quite grand that I go to the market every morning. It's because I go for tacos every morning. You know.
You mean there's some kind of a stand and they
absolutely.
And yeah. what is a breakfast taco like in Mexico?
Well, on some days, I mean, I love morcilla, which is blood sausage.
Sure.
You know that. Yeah. And there's one that's a mixed seafood. It's conch and shrimp and
yeah.
all that kind of thing. Octopus, calamari, yeah. zutinto, you know, I mean, yeah. Just on and on and on.
And this is a daily ritual for you when
yes.
you're there?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you walk the market?
And then I walk the market.
And how big a market are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about 20 stalls probably. Uh-huh. I mean, half of them fruit, half of them vegetables.
Uh-huh.
One great big florist one, you know. So
yeah.
You buy, 12 Bird of Paradise for $5.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's enough to make me want to move.
Yeah. Right. So.
But what kind of things are you cooking? Like when you, what's something you've made in the last, what comes to mind when I even just mentioned that? Something that you made and just loved it.
Well, I mean, it sounds ridiculous because it's Mexico, but I got really excited a couple of months ago when artichokes, globe artichokes, first arrived in the markets in Merida.
Yeah.
But that's got nothing to do with Mexico. It's just I hadn't seen them
yeah,
in a
that's
long
fine.
Time.
You know? Yeah. What'd you do with them?
Mainly, I cooked them in the microwave and then fried them in olive oil with a little bit of garlic.
Okay.
And served them with Meyer lemons. I mean, mm-hmm. their version of Meyer lemon called yep. Lemon Dulce.
Yeah.
So... it's whatever's there, but,
yeah.
but particularly, I mean, I love to cook the octopus
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And a fish called bocconetti, which is hogfish.
Uh-huh.
Just fantastic. It's dyed the clams. Little, yeah. It's nothing but little clams
yes.
out of the sand. And so you can imagine what a fish tastes like.
Sure.
It's only clams.
Yeah. What about restaurants? Where have you been that you've liked, wherever in the world, in the last... what are some meals you've really enjoyed?
Well, I mean, I was in a week ago, I was in Sri Lanka,
mm-hmm.
and I ordered, I saw they had a crab menu. So they served a green curry, crab curry with a whole crab.
Yeah.
It took 45 minutes before the food arrived, and we couldn't figure out what was going on.
Yeah.
And this guy came rushing up the beach
yeah.
with a platter full of crabs. And as he got up to the restaurant, they yeah. all fell off and started running around the floor. I mean, it sounds ludicrous, but
yeah.
that's exactly what happened. They scooped right. them up, ran in the kitchen,
yeah.
and then, you know, another 35 minutes, the curry appeared.
Mm-hmm.
Really, just because of that setting and on the beach, you know, in
yeah,
Lanka,
yeah, yeah.
and the drama.
Yeah.
And the curry was actually delicious.
Yeah. That's fun. Do you like seeing your food alive?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I go down to the beach 30 minutes away from where we live.
Yeah.
And wait for the fishermen to bring in lobsters or, you know, stone crab claws. Sorry.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm a, you know, I grew up as a Florida boy, so.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with those.
Right.
Have you been to Wu's Wonton House in New York City?
No.
Do you know about it?
No.
It's on East Broadway.
Right.
And one of the things they do, I think it might be by special arrangement, but they do a crab dinner. You have to come with a group of people.
Right.
And they start you off with a few little bites to start. It's a very casual place.
Right.
And, but then they, all of us, and I didn't see it coming. I had my back to the kitchen. I'll show you after we interview, but they drop this giant crab in the middle of the table. And it sort of looks at everyone for a minute or two and they take it away. And then there's, I think, three different courses. There's a rice, but
oh,
it
fantastic.
Turns up in all these different dishes that they then serve you.
Right.
And then you can order whatever else you want.
Right.
But it's phenomenal.
What a wonderful idea.
It's yeah. phenomenal.
Yeah.
How did the movie change? It sounds like an odd question to ask someone who'd already been so well known, but how did the movie change your life? I mean, are you recognized a lot these days?
I think the strangest thing that came from the movie was I was on a dive boat in Cozumel, and the kid who doesn't speak any English a Mayan kid barely speaks Spanish.
Yeah.
He came over to me and said, I loved your movie in Spanish. And I was like, what? How is that possible? Of course, it's Netflix.
Sure.
But I think that was the biggest surprise of all. But of all ages. I mean, that was the appeal of Tony Bourdain, you know, that he was really across all the ages and all the classes.
Yeah.
Different levels of society. And that happened with the movie. I mean, there's that same spirit of Tony in it, you know?
Yeah. Well, are you saying because he was involved with it? Or you mean, yeah.
Yeah. And then,
but
and
that speaks to his power also, because he wasn't, like, he didn't narrate it.
No, no.
He produced it, so his name was on it.
And he was interviewed.
And he's interviewed in it, but he's along with several other people. But it's not like, you know, for the casual observer, he was that much of a presence in it. But I think that does speak to his...
His power.
His power was just still, I mean, just astonishing.
I mean, we were going to the Charlie Rose show and for the promote the film.
Yeah.
And there was some picketing. They were picketing CBS, and there were these, you know, professional New Jersey Italian picketers across the street.
Yeah.
And they were making a huge noise, and we got out of the car, and they saw Tony, and they went, Tony, 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 Tony. And he walked across the street and said, guys, we're about to do an interview. Could you keep the noise down for about 30 minutes? They were like mice. We came out, and they were just still standing there. And he went over and thanked them and everything. Who else in the world could shut up a bunch of professional New York picketers, you know?
Yeah, he was... I mean, I always qualify it. I didn't know him well.
Yeah.
I was lucky to meet him several times. I was lucky to interview him a few times.
Right.
It's so fascinating to me what happened with him. Did you know him when he was younger, when he was like the Kitchen Confidential era?
When he
first sort of broke?
No, but I knew him when he had the restaurant in Manhattan.
Okay, so...
Leal.
You know, it was interesting to me, as he aged, it was almost the opposite of what happens with most people. He seemed to get, and I don't mean heavy, but bigger. When you see pictures of him in those Kitchen Confidential days... He was like a little scrappy, you know? He wasn't... And then you saw pictures of him later, in his late 50s, and his hands looked really big, and his face looked very, you know, like stone-jawed, and it was interesting to me.
I mean, he seemed like a foot taller.
Yeah, right, you know, exactly.
I mean, it sounds ludicrous to say it, but that's
the
impression.
Yeah.
Because he was... it wasn't just fame, but it was confidence and his ability. He was
a
very intelligent, very articulate guy.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he came into his own. I think he stood up a foot taller, you know.
You noticed the similar thing. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's very striking. Okay, we're going to be at our destination soon, but last question. You've kept writing. You've been writing. You wrote your book on manners.
Yes.
And why they...
Table
manners, right? You wrote
and
your...
And Why Bother.
And Why Bother. You wrote your Escoffier book.
Right.
You did a reissue and largely rewritten version of what used to be known as California Dish, which is Start the Fire.
Right.
Any other writing projects on the horizon?
Well, and yes.
If you can talk about them.
As soon as this calms down, I'm going to finish a book. It's going to be... a more tell-all version of Start the Fire.
Really?
Yeah.
Overlapping the same time period?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, on
I
that
I can't
note,
talk about it too much because I'm not quite sure.
No, that's fine. That's good to be continued.
In the works, yeah.
All right. Well, as always, Jeremiah, thank you.
Thank you.
Always an honor to speak with you.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
Thank you. Okay, so can I just, for you two, since we're doing this together, can you just get people, orient people voice-wise? Can you just say your name?
I'm Clark. I'm Mark.
Okay, so.
We sound alike.
You do sound alike, but that's okay. People survive.
And look alike.
Twins.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so let me just throw it out there very generally. We're here celebrating Jeremiah. How did you first become aware of this person?
Oh, for me, I was had Jonathan Tower as a professor at my school, and I was moving up to San Francisco, and Jonathan said, "You know, my brother's opening a place up in San Francisco. Do you need a job?" And I said, "Well, yeah, of course I need a job. I don't have a job." He said, "Well, go and talk to my brother Jeremiah and see if he can fix you up." I had no idea who Jeremiah is. So
okay.
I just showed up looking for a prep position.
Okay.
I ended up being hired.
And what was this pre-opening?
That was about 3 days before the
actual before Stars opening. Opened.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Maybe and 4 days.
What kind of experience did you have at that point?
Pre-opening or being hired or
what experience did you arrive in San Francisco with?
I had worked all through high school and junior high and college and all that sort of thing.
Okay.
In food service, if you will, in restaurants.
Yeah.
But nothing of the caliber or nature of Stars. So it was a rude awakening for me.
Yeah.
But it was really very intense, and I loved restaurants as a kid. You know, loved eating out and all that sort of. So I realized, wow, this is pretty amazing what's happening here.
What was your first impression of him? Do you remember? Do you remember when you first met him?
Exactly, at the interview.
Yeah.
It was down in the basement of Stars, and I was standing there, and this very handsome, aristocratic-looking guy walked in, and I'm like, well, it looked a lot like his brother, of course, and I thought, oh, this is obviously Jeremiah, and then he's just like looking at me like, who's this kid? What's he doing here? And then we sat down, and he said, well, how much money do you want? And I said, well, I'll take $5 an hour, which even in 1984 wasn't very much money,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I can't pay you that. That's too little. And I said, well, whatever you want to pay me. I'm only here for the experience. And he said, you're hired.
That was it.
And that was it.
Okay.
And the next day I showed up and worked my butt off for the rest of the time I was there.
Right. Same question. First, how'd you hear about this person, and how did you first, how do you first remember him?
I didn't know a lot about Jeremiah, and I was working in Boston and Maine in a number of restaurants, and I was really bored. I was like, I need to go west. I mm-hmm. need to do something mm-hmm. different. And I was flying out on United Airlines, mm-hmm. and there was a big spread about Jeremiah Tower and Stars. And I thought, wow, that's what I want to do.
You mean like in the in-flight magazine?
In the in-flight magazine, yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, it sounds really hokey, but that's where...
People
that's
actually where used to read the in-flight magazine.
Yeah. And I did. It was, you know, something to do. And I was like, wow, this looks really amazing. I want to go work for this man. So I was out visiting my sister for a few weeks, and I went back to Maine and kind of packed everything up and came back out. And I went into Stars one day, and JT actually wasn't there, but I met Mark Franz.
Mm-hmm.
And I
Who was his want to call it. Jeremiah refers to him as his chef, basically the chef de cuisine.
Chef de cuisine, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he and I seemed to hit it off really well, and he pretty much hired me on the spot. I had dressed up nicely, and, you know, I had my resume and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, they show up looking like the wrath of God and whatever. But so I didn't really know much. I walked in, and I was fairly intimidated. And I had been in a position of being a chef, but in nowhere like that.
Yes.
And so I had a lot more experience going into Stars than mm-hmm. Clark did, perhaps. But then I remember meeting Jeremiah. I probably had worked there for maybe a week before I met him, and I was in the kitchen. Maybe not a week, but he was gone somewhere.
Yeah.
He was the early days of Stars. He was traveling a bit, too.
Yeah.
It wasn't the very beginning. They were open about 6 months, I think, after I started.
Yeah.
And I remember suddenly seeing this man, and I was like, oh, boy.
Because what?
I just was scared. I mean, I thought, you know, wow, he's a real, you know, a real legend here. And
already he had that sort of
had that aura.
Struck that kind of a figure.
Yes. Yes. And I, you know, he introduced himself to me. I'm like, oh, yeah, of course you're Jeremiah Tower.
Yeah.
And I, you know, introduced myself, and, you know, he was very pleasant, and mm-hmm. we just chit chatted for a little while. And then, you know, I went back to what I was doing, and he went around to, you know, expedite or whatever he was doing.
Sure.
And I just remember feeling like I was really excited, but really scared.
I am struck. It's interesting for me to hear you say that. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly heard other people relate stories of intimidation, and, you know, especially if they did something really dumb. And I don't mean dumb in the way most cooks would think I mean dumb. There's a story actually in my book, Andy Forsheimer. Did either of you overlap
with
him?
We worked with him.
Okay, well, he told the story of putting up a salad that had brown lettuce in it, and Jeremiah took a brown lettuce leaf and made him eat it, and said, well, you wanted our customers to eat it, you eat it. you know? So I don't mean dumb like someone made a mistake. I mean dumb like showed disrespect for the customer or did something that he considered really like almost morally reprehensible, right? But I am struck. I've been lucky. We were all out. I was somehow got invited to join you guys, but you all had a little bit of a Stars late night steakhouse reunion last night.
That was great.
And I've been at other meals like that. I was at Zuni Cafe once after an event in San Francisco at Foreign Cinema years ago, and Steve Vranian and Emily Luchetti and, you know, Jewel Vranian, they were there.
Yeah.
And for a guy who does have this larger than life persona, right? Who, when I first met just as a journalist, I wasn't trying to get a job.
Right.
I told him, I said, I'm very intimidated to meet you. And I don't know anyone else I've ever said that to. The warmth that he seems to have toward his cooks is touching. It's really palpable. And I know we're years away from that restaurant now, and I know a lot, you guys, have, most of you, a lot of you had your own places now. But was that also part of it at the time? Was he a warm figure at times as well, or was he always sort of imperious?
I don't think he was always imperious. I felt like he was very, could be very tough at times to work for, but I never felt like he was unfair.
Mm.
I always felt like what he expected and what he demanded was fair. And if you couldn't do that, well, then you could go somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. But
he didn't suffer fools very well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, he made some comment at Pebble Beach, I think, when we were doing our luncheon together last year. He's like, well, that's why everybody always said I was an asshole or something.
What was the story?
And I can't remember the story, but something, you know, had happened.
Yes.
And I said, no, I never thought you were an asshole. I said, it could be difficult and intimidating, but you were always totally fair.
Yeah.
He's like, oh yeah, that's a much nicer way of putting it.
where do you weigh in on this question of when I think about last night, is that something that happened more over the years since? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
As soon as I ask the question, but you know, a lot of chefs feel you can't be that close to the troops, right? Did he keep that kind of a remove, or did it toggle back and forth?
I remember very well a lot of times he would be, not intimate's not quite the right word, but very close to you, and would discuss things like, you know, going out or this and that, you know, just chit chat. But also, as we were, Mark and I, or I was there longer, he would talk about the food, you know, as a colleague to colleague. Mm-hmm. And that was a nice feeling because he was sort of bringing you into the fold.
He was like, interested in what you thought. Yeah, he was interested in your taste and your ideas.
Exactly. And not so, maybe not so much ideas, but certainly like, well, what does this need? We need to add, you know, this doesn't quite tasting right. What do we need to add? So there was an inclusiveness that not all chefs have. I think that was very important. It was obvious that he was the star of the show, but there was a fierce loyalty amongst the people that were the core staff there. Mm-hmm. A lot of people came and went because it was not an easy kitchen to work in.
Was that a clicky thing or was that a talent thing?
I think it was a dedication thing. It was interesting for me to go through the albums that Jules and Steve Vranian had brought last night, because you could see that this was not just, okay, the designers designed the restaurant and so on, and then we just brought this stuff in and we wrote this menu and then we executed it. It was all about the whole group of them creating that restaurant together. Mm-hmm. And once we had been involved in it for a while, you started to be brought into that feeling. So when you say warmth, I feel like there was a real, you had to be kind of a little bit part of the family to start to experience that.
I mean, the
warmth.
Word I use is tribal.
Yeah, a bit tribal. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I would definitely say so.
I've said this for years, and I may be missing something. There may be this kind of community around Chez Panisse, and I just don't see it. But, you know, I feel like the most fiercely, and I don't mean this in a positive way, the most fiercely loyal past employees that I've met have been the former employees of Jeremiah and of Barry Wine.
That's very
from the Quilted Giraffe.
Yeah.
Both groups still get together periodically. Yeah. Both groups still get together with those the chef at the center of the universe, their universe periodically.
Yes.
And we're talking decades on, right?
Yes.
I don't know other restaurants. Like Jonathan Waxman has a crew.
Yes.
They come by his restaurant, Barbudo, mm-hmm. but it's not the same thing. They're not throwing like jams reunion dinners, you know? Mm. And but this is a semi-regular thing with you all.
Yeah.
What do you think when I say that? It seems like this resonates with you both.
It does, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like we all were learning so much at the time and growing so much together. We did become very close, and it was a tight group, and it took a while until you were really felt like you were part of the group. But I really remember when it happened, and I was like, I'm not afraid of these people anymore. I'm kind of, you know, I still had to look up to them, obviously, and respect them. And they were, you know, higher up the totem pole than I was.
Yeah.
But I felt like I was definitely part of the family. And what you say about all of us staying together over the years, or staying in touch, rather, with one another, is so true. I mean, we've had a dozen different stars chefs to our restaurants in Maine, and we've gone to their restaurants
to do special dinners
to do events,
and
to do events.
And yeah,
you know, that's just been wonderful. And Jeremiah has been to our flagship restaurant, the former Arrows, you know, a number of times, and was there to support us. And it's a really interesting group. And now with Facebook, I've even sort of reconnected with.
There's a Stars alum Facebook group.
Yeah.
I think also that I always felt it was one of the most unique gatherings of chefs ever.
At Stars?
That I, you know, maybe there were others who worked for Karam or somebody. But when my career since, I've rarely seen the sort of dynamic, talented group of people coming together. And that's when you see the Stars universe that we're seeing now. Mm-hmm. So many people went out. You mentioned Andy Forsheimer, Emily Lucchetti, Mark Franz. And you look at their accolades and what they've done.
Yeah.
And it's pretty impressive. All those people were in the same room working together for a number of years.
Well, that's just the tip. I mean,
and just the tip of the iceberg.
What's his name? Who started Chipotle?
Chipotle. I mean, all these
Steve Ells. Brendan Walsh, who went on to become a big Southwestern chef in New York and is now the dean of the CIA.
Amazing group of people.
Really, yeah.
That all those people were in that one kitchen over those years is just phenomenal.
So what, you know, it was one. It's interesting to me because I think it's such a, this is a very intricate question. I don't know how to say it. I think one of the reasons for that obviously was Jeremiah at the middle of it, right? I think also one of the reasons was there were just fewer places like that, mm-hmm. which also means there were fewer chefs like him who were sort of doing revolutionary things at the time, right? Mm-hmm. So like today, you know, you do still hear about restaurants like this. People who were at Alinea in Chicago when it opened talk about it very much the same way.
Yes.
You know, because it was like John Shields and Curtis, I'm blanking on his last name, Curtis Duffy, and Alex Stupak was the opening pastry chef, you know?
Right.
But it's rare because there's so many places for people to go now.
Yes.
Do you think that was a factor in it? And I'm not minimizing what that was.
I agree that it is a factor when you look at the explosions of restaurants just in New York City.
Sure.
Say, last 10 years, 10,000 new openings.
Yeah.
There's only so many people in New York City, still 3 million, let's say. And you have as many, maybe a few more people in the culinary world than were in the culinary world when we were kids. We were having this very discussion last night and this morning about how many restaurants have opened. So you have to say there is something to that.
Mm-hmm.
I just add to that. I think it was such a time of change in America and cooking and the restaurant industry. Mm-hmm. And Jeremiah was sort of spearheading that with the whole California cuisine movement. And it was so exciting. And that you had this group of amazingly talented people all working together more than I've ever seen under one roof anywhere before or after. I mean, it was just incredible. And like Clark said, a lot of them have gone off and done their own things, but it was a real,
everything was in such a flux then, and things were really changing. And yeah,
and I want to just interject one little story about how big the change has been.
Sure.
Nowadays, everybody sees chefs as very glamorous, and they're on TV, and they're on podcasts, and they're on radio, and they're doing things, and you know, it's super glamorous. But in 1984. Jeremiah and a few other people, Wolfgang Puck and so on, were starting to make that profession glamorous. But even then, when I was living in San Francisco, my roommate was older than me. He was at the ancient age of 40. And his parents were coming from Louisiana. And he seemed very uptight. And I thought, finally, I said, Greg, what the hell is with you? You know, your parents are coming. What, they don't know you're gay, or is that the problem? He said, no, they know I'm gay. You know, that's not the deal. And he kind of fished around a little more.
Was this someone who worked in the industry?
No, okay. He didn't.
Yeah.
And so then that's part of the story,
okay.
Because he finally got to the point. He said, well, what's the deal, Greg? What is your problem? He said, you know, I'm living with a cook, meaning me, and my parents are not going to like the fact that I'm living in a cook. Because in Louisiana, cooks shouldn't be living with me. And it's not good enough for a person like me.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my gosh, here we are in San Francisco, 1984. All this stuff is happening and chefs are becoming this glamorous commodity.
Yeah.
And yet we still have that. So I think we've really come a huge difference. A huge distance, rather.
Yeah. It's very funny to me. Jody Williams, do you know that name? She's a chef in New York. She has a Bouvette. So openly gay chef. And Jody, I had had a conversation with Evan Kleinman in Los Angeles when we were doing my book. And she was telling me the story of like working up to telling her parents that she wanted to be a cook, right? and back in the late 70s. And I said, it was like I had heard a version of that story like 20 times. And I said, oh my God, this was like your guys' version of coming out.
Yeah.
And she said, you know what? It kind of was. Yeah. And so I then, like within weeks of that, I interviewed Jody for my book and I told her the story. And she says, well, you know something, Andrew? I sat my father down one day and I said, I have two pieces of bad news for you. I'm gay and I want to be a cook.
Which was worse, right?
The cook.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In her case, the cook. Yeah. But can I ask you a question along those lines? Can you help me? I'm blanking on his name. Tronfield. Tronfield, who had Herb Farm restaurant in Poppy in Seattle.
Exactly.
So, you know, he told me that as a gay man in the industry at that time, that Jeremiah was very important to him personally because of his success in an industry that even today, you know, is not known. People don't say this, and people do the benefits, and you know, but it's not. There's still not that many openly gay male chefs.
Exactly.
Yes,
right.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head.
Right. But was he important to you guys in that way?
Absolutely.
Can you speak to that for a minute?
I think Jeremiah being openly gay, male celebrity chef. It was very important to me. I thought, wow, this is really, something. It was very unusual, and you know what you were saying, it still is unusual.
Yeah.
It's still, Clark and I have talked about this on and on and on and on. You know, the industry is still, it's very macho. It really is. It's you're working with a lot of kind of almost blue collar type people, and it can be a really rough business, and it's not always the easiest place for gay men, even after you're really successful. And, we feel like we've had a lot of success, but it's still difficult at times. Or you hear something being said, you hear snide comments or whatever, or you catch this sort of errant look where somebody's kind of sneering at you or whatever. And it's not a paranoia. It's not.
No.
It's real. And I think that it's still a very, very tiny percentage of really successful, famous chefs are gay men.
Well, it's funny on this show, because I try to have this show be as diverse as possible and not just racially, right? Generationally, geographically. I mean, if somebody comes through New York and I get a shot at having an interview, I will move heaven and earth to get them because I don't just want to be a New York show, right?
Right.
And I was doing kind of a little personal assessment over the holidays, and I realized that I'm sure there are people, you know, I haven't had many people from Kosovo on the show, right? Mm. But in terms of if you were going to categorize guests, the most underrepresented sort of large group that I on my show has been gay male chefs. Yeah. And what's funny about that to me is I only do in-person interviews, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know who it's not like I've been to, you know, from the earliest childhood, I've had like no, you know, I worked in a, not a restaurant, I worked in a Steve's Ice Cream. Okay, and, you know, my boss was openly gay. I mean, you know, this was like in the early 80s.
Sure.
You know, I have a cousin, I had an uncle, you know, I was very, and I did a lot of theater growing up. Not that's a stereotypical comment, but it's true.
But it's true. But it's true.
So it's very weird given my own personal biography that's the case. But I mean, it's like, who would it have been? You know, like, and
it's such a funny thing.
It's very strange.
I feel in the public's view still, there's this persona that, oh, a lot of chefs must be gay. Perhaps that comes because of that sort of traditional channeling of your waiter is gay, of which, for example, at Starz, a lot of the waiters were gay. But the back cooks. Of the house, Jerry Tromphill, Mark and I, and maybe one or two other, maybe.
No, that was about it.
That was about it.
Interesting.
Four of us out of 40 cooks or whatever.
Interesting. Yeah. In San Francisco at that time.
In San Francisco, yeah.
And so there's
when you say the waiter thing, you're talking, I think that's even a little old school now.
It is.
Like the idea that in New York, like your waiter's like an out of work actor.
Who's gay. And maybe that's not as true. I don't think it is. But at that time, it kind of was.
Yes.
There was a lot of that division, like, you know, a woman's place is in the home, and the gay guy's place in the restaurant is in the front of the house as a waiter.
Right, right.
And you know, women, if they have a profession, they should be school teachers.
Yeah.
It's funny how close we are to that time, and how far we have or haven't come.
But is it? But going back to him, right?
Yeah.
What did that mean for individually for you guys in terms of? Did it give you a belief that? What you wanted out of the industry was possible? Did it make you a little less, you said before you weren't being paranoid, right?
Yeah.
But did it make you a little less concerned, I guess, about what people might be thinking or saying when you weren't in the room?
Right. It really empowered me, I think. It made me feel a lot more comfortable, a lot more strong, a lot more determined. I've told Jeremiah for years now. I mean, I learned more in 2.5 years from him than I ever learned in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And that Clark and I, well, first of all, wouldn't be together. And, you know, secondly, we wouldn't be where we are if we hadn't worked for him.
Yes.
And it was a game changer for
also, when Mark and I met as Starz, and you know, that's often a problem in any business.
Sure.
Even we've had many people get together in our restaurants.
Yes.
And, you know, you have an issue with that. And he was supportive of us being together. We kind of got the father talk, like, okay, you guys can be together. And he makes it quite funny, which is true. We couldn't stand each other at first. And he was quite happy with that. He was quite pleased with that development. But once we got together, we got the father talk, like, okay, you guys, that's okay. But you need to be professional when you come in through my door. And that was good, too, because he provided a very professional outlook on it wasn't – and there was no favoritism, I might add, too, which was also a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, he supported us because he knew that we were good people in his organization. Not, I feel, because, there might be a little extra, but he never showed any sort of favoritism because we were the gay guys in his kitchen.
Yes.
That was not the case at all.
Never,
if anything, he bent over backwards – to not appear that
way.
I think he was harder on us.
Which was probably a good thing for us because he expected more, maybe because he realized that it's not easy for people, gay chefs going forward, that it wasn't going to be easy for us. So, you know, I think that was, he pushed us maybe a little harder even, which is kind of
a good thing.
Was a very good thing.
Yeah.
What's the most, how do you think, you know, there's been the movie, The Last Magnificent, he's out there a ton. We just did a little interview in the car coming over here, which was fun. What do you think the biggest misconception is about him? What do you think of in terms of this public, his public persona? I mean, it's such a complicated persona. It's such an outsized persona. Do you feel like there's something that's been overstated or that has been just left out? I'll give you one for instance. I know Emily Luchetti, who was the pastry chef at Starz, feels like, certainly in the movie, that there was not enough appreciation of how important his food was.
Yes.
You know, how much he, the term I use is move the ball forward, right?
I think that the movie, as good as it was a great film, but I don't think quite got across the impact of what Jeremiah did in this country. And we want all of our people that work with us in our restaurants to see the movie, because I don't feel that a lot of younger people in our profession really even understand the tremendous amount of impact that he had on the way we dine, not just eat.
Yes.
It wasn't just the food, it was the whole package that he brought. And I'm not sure that that quite got across in the film, because you saw Chez Panisse a lot, and then you saw Starz. And there was a whole lot more. There was Balboa Cafe, there was Santa Fe, there was Ventana, and all these things. I remember as a kid going down to Ventana and having this amazing lunch like no other experience I'd ever had in my young life. I was probably 14 at the time. It was mind-blowing, and it was we didn't even know what was happening. And right. But the whole, all these things, you know, open kitchen. Now every restaurant in America has an open kitchen. But it wasn't so back then.
Yeah.
You know, having fancy, you know, you could have an upscale dinner or whatever you want to call it, a high-end dinner. Or you could come in and have a hamburger. That didn't exist. You went to the Blue Fox for fancy food in San Francisco. And you went to Tadige's for, you know, simple fare and so on. They weren't together. That whole stylish feel that Jeremiah introduced is how American restaurants are today. And I don't think people understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are other people that added to that, Wolfgang, so on, many, many, many people.
Yeah.
But I think he really hit the nail on the head, and such a home run that was so inspirational. I mean,
so many younger cooks and chefs, they weren't even born yet when this was happening.
Yeah.
You know, I have kids that are working for us, and I'm like, oh, I'm older than your parents, or, you know. But they don't understand it because they weren't around then, and I think that they see this whole different world that's evolved of, you know, Guy Fieri and the big, you know, splashy, you know, whatever you want to call it, theatrics and television chefs, you know, and top chef masters, you know, which we did sort of begrudgingly. I didn't want to do it because.
Oh, you guys did Top Chef Masters?
Yeah, we did. Okay. In 2011. I think, yeah.
Jonathan Waxman was one of the judges.
Yeah. He was a judge. Okay. I remember I think the only season of that I watched was the one where he competed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It was like him and Ludo.
That was years
ago. Him, Ludo, Rick Moonen.
Yeah.
It was a fun crowd.
Yeah.
Did you two come on as a team?
Yes.
We competed against each other. I mean, that was part of the shtick.
Oh, so you weren't a team. You were on individually.
We were not a team.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, we were.
We were, but we were. And we sort of were, though. Yeah. We helped each other.
Yeah.
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 But so I think a lot of kids have this. They don't understand what happened in the 80s and what Clark was saying, how much it changed the way people eat in America. You know, where they eat, how they eat, what they eat, all that.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning of farm to table. You know, yes. You know, there wasn't a garden out in Redwood Alley in San Francisco, but you know. Things were cut and brought down to the city, you know, the star farm, you know, brought greens down every day and things like that. And everything, I mean, the food that came in was so fresh and so beautiful and so seasonal.
Yeah.
And that was very different.
Yeah.
And
everybody takes that for granted now. It's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And we all think that's the way it always has been. And it wasn't. If you want to see an image of what it was like, you know, watch Vertigo, Hitchcock's film. And
you mean the restaurants?
Restaurant scenes at Ernie's. That was San Francisco.
That was San Francisco.
High-class restaurant dining the 50s. Yeah. And that's how it was, you know, quiet, linen-draped tables, candlelight, women and men all dressed up, very, very, you know, beautiful in many ways. I mean, sometimes I wish we could go back to that era at times, you know, when you can't hear yourself think and so on. But, that whole world that Jeremiah introduced was changed the way Americans eat, and they don't know it.
Yeah, well, it's also, I mean, that's interesting. And it's also, to me, like, there's this thing that, like, David Chang now, right? You can go to, so he did the noodle bar.
Yeah.
And then he did, his second place was Momofuku Sambar, which I know a lot of older restaurateurs and chefs who were very angry when they got 3 stars because it was backless, you know, backless chairs, waiters in t-shirts, right? But the food was primo, right? And I kind of feel like that seemed revolutionary at the time, right? Except if you knew about a place like Stars,
you saw
which was a grand space, but you could come in there wearing whatever you wanted, basically.
And,
and you could also get a burger.
And you could get a burger. You could get a hot dog when
you
first
opened. Right, right, right.
That didn't last long, but...
No, but I'm just saying that, you know, it was that, and that was, you know, decades earlier. You know, that sort of mix of high-quality product in a very malleable, you know, setting.
You could show up in a... You know, tails and you know, women in ball gowns for the opening of the opera, but they would be sitting perhaps next to somebody in a t-shirt and jeans.
Yes,
that just didn't happen 5 years before that.
Right. Yeah. Great. All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fun. Good interview. Meeting you both. First of all, can everyone just say their names into the mic so I can just ID the voices?
Steve Varanian.
Jewel Varanian.
Lisa Sheehan.
Bruce Hill.
Okay. And you guys, I all know. Lisa, you were at Stars?
I was. I was the manager at Stars from 1991 to 1994.
Perfect. Okay. So, well, why don't we, everyone's telling me you have this great story. Should we just go right to it? Do we need to warm up to that, or you want to just let it go? Okay.
We don't need to warm up.
Hit us.
So this is a classic, JT story, and I was downstairs in the basement, which was vast and organized and where all the good stuff happens, and I was randomly eating a banana, and I was walking back upstairs, and JT comes running down the staircase, and his eyes are literally as big as saucers, and he looks at me, and he says, "Lisa, put that banana down and go guard the wild boar." And I was like, okay, I got you. And in any other universe, that would be code for something. And in this case, it was not code for anything. The health department was upstairs, and we had a wild boar hanging upside down in the storeroom. And so I ran over to the store. I threw the banana away, ran over to the storeroom. I locked the door, and, you know, again, this is in 1991, and so prior to cellular phones, you had to. So I had to look like I was doing something. I grabbed a clipboard, and I thought, surely they'll think, okay, she's doing inventory. And two gentlemen come walking down. And I'm standing, I'm guarding the wild boar, and they're like, wow, this place is really, wow, this is vast. It's pretty tidy down here. And they walked right by me, peeked into where we would do a lot of the prep work and where the liquor was stored. We had big liquor cages down there, and they turned around and waltzed right back upstairs. But I just thought that is so classic, JT. To, you know, it was really something. That place was totally magical, and it was wild as that boar. It was just crazy, crazy.
Thank you for that. What is this? What does that exemplify? What is that? What does that speak to you guys about that? Everyone's grinning broadly. Around this table.
Boy. I mean, I think it's just that the energy that, you know, in the restaurant, throughout the restaurant, and you know, the family close ties that we all had for each other and with each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we weren't going to let anybody slow down or shut down Stars,
even if it meant there was a wild boar in a non-refrigerated dry storage area.
Uh-huh. It's funny. I interviewed Mark and Clark right before this, and they were talking about how a lot of people came and went, you know, like didn't really last. Bruce, you and I did an interview where you talked about the kitchen. It's one of my favorite analogies as like a, as a pack, right? Like certain animals, animals figure it out, get corrected by the mama and can survive. And once in a while, an outlier gets kind of left behind, right? That happens. That was, you were talking about the Star's Kitchen. Yeah. But they were talking about it in the terms of like this absolute devotion that everyone who was, you're nodding, Jewel.
Absolutely.
That everyone who lasted there, and lasted sounds like too derogatory way to put it. Everyone who stayed there.
Wanted to be there
and wanted to be all in.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
We just were such a strong team. And what we loved is that we weren't there for the paycheck. We were there for the love of what we were all doing. And we were sharing, you know, this whole commitment with everybody. So we always did have each other's back covered. You know, for no matter what, you know, if you had to run to the store or, you know, out to the car or whatever, you did it just without question.
Yeah. So can we go around the horn? I'm going to start with you, Bruce. Yeah. Do you have something you want to say first?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
You had something you want to say?
Yeah, I wanted just to
go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
So if I was going to add to that, the other thing I think was really obvious looking back now is how much we trusted each other. And there was a ton of
everyone's trust. Nodding at that.
And we also knew, because we did see people coming in fairly often, and everyone who came in had to come in as a prep cook. You did not come in and even work the line at all. So if you were going to stay, that meant you understood that concept of going to the next and the next and the next level. And the people who couldn't go to that next level or go up a couple of levels, you knew that they were never going to go anywhere. So they just never went anywhere, and they left, and someone else replaced them that was stronger.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there was this – that was how it went. Steve's going to add to that.
I'm thinking about this a lot, and what I really believe happened before Stars, after Chez Panisse, there was a Balboa Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
So you
had – where Jeremiah was the chef.
And Jeremiah took over, and so there was literally, like, two people and him in the kitchen, and you worked side by side, and that was the whole kitchen. Then a year or so later, Santa Fe Bar and Grill. Kitchen's a little bit bigger. A couple more people come in. That family gets tighter. The same people from the Balboa come over. And then the next step goes up the Stars. And so you have that foundation of whatever that culture is. But to me, it started really small. It started really hands-on. And that core group from Santa Fe was, you know, then expanded to the core group at Stars.
Yeah. Well, it was also what he was up to, right? He was kind of figuring out what he was all...
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think he needed a paycheck, too.
Yes, but I mean, he had a place to sort of start working out ideas.
He had the lease for Stars.
Yeah.
For 3 years before it opened. So he was constantly having to look for investors, and that's what happened with the Balboa, Doyle Moon, Santa Fe Bar and Grill.
Yep.
And then Stars. That's a whole different story.
Can we go around the horn? I'm curious, because I did this with Mark and Clark. I'd love to know everybody's first recollection of meeting Jeremiah and what your impression was, how he struck you. Let's start with you, Lisa.
Sure. I was referred to Stars by another manager. She had previously worked there, Lori Tice. And Lori, I was at Kimpton at the time, and I was young. I mean, I was a young manager, and I was, and Lori said, you know what, I think you would be great at Stars. She's like, I want to introduce you to Tony and Gotti. And she said, I really think that your energy is exactly what they need in the dining room. And I was like, all right, you know, what did I know? I didn't know. You knew, I knew it was a wonderful restaurant. I loved that they had a piano player, you know, 7 nights a week. And I just loved it was sort of iconic then. And again, this is in the very early 90s. And I met Tony, and I remember he said, I'm going to bring Jeremiah down. And I thought, okay, that'll be great. And he came down, and he was, you know, of course, starched, you know, perfectly pressed and, you know, very buttoned up. And he said, hello, Lisa. And he said, Tony thinks that you would be wonderful here. And I said, thank you. And he said, this is probably unlike any other place you have ever worked or will work. And I thought, okay. And he says, I think you're going to like it here. And I that it was really sort of simple. Clearly, Tony had already kind of prepped him and said, you know, we're going to bring the scale in. And ever since then, I the things that I learned there and the way that the hospitality that Jeremiah insisted upon and the graciousness and the kindness is maybe seems a little antithesis, you know, the antithesis of the kitchen side of it, but it was really how we had to, how we presented ourselves up front. And I just said to him 5 minutes ago when I saw him, I said, and somebody new came right over and I said, oh, it's nice to see you. And I looked at JT, I said, you taught me that. It's the first thing that you say, it's nice to see you instead of nice to meet you, because oftentimes people would come and say, I've been at Stars 5 times. Don't you remember me? And so it's always, and for the past 28 years, I say it's
Can I tell you something funny? I met Mark and Clark for the first time last night, and they both said to me, good to see you.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, it's a JT and we thing. 100% have never met before.
It's a JT
thing. I'm entirely positive of it.
Yeah, I love it. That, yeah. It has stayed with me for yeah.
the only,
28 years.
The only, the best bluff I ever heard was the writer George Plimpton.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Came up with this thing that was so if somebody says, you know, hi, I'm Bruce Hill, you say, ah, the famous Bruce Hill.
Oh, I see.
Which is a good one, too.
That's but a that good was, one. It's yes. nice to see you.
Yeah.
It's always nice
Fail
to
safe.
See you.
Yeah.
Fail safe.
Okay. Thank you. Can I, Bruce, I'll ask you this and then tell me your story. Do you think, because, you know, a lot of people tell about these getting hired stories, right? Mm-hmm. And if it was him and not somebody like Mark who made the hire. Mm-hmm. But do you think there was one thing that you united the people that he gave the seal of approval to come work there? Do you think there was one particular quality that he looked for?
Oh, that Jeremiah looked for in all of us?
Do you think there's a common thing?
I think all he looked for was good attitude and a willingness and a commitment and someone with passion for food and flavors.
Okay.
I think that he could recognize that.
Yeah.
You know, we tasted a lot of stuff together.
Yeah.
We would think of these dishes and then that go to sleep and wake up, come the next day and make them. And then we have to taste them.
Yeah.
And balance them and talk about what we tasted. It was kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
That we tasted so much food on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'll what say, was your first?
Just, I want to add on that. I also say good to see you. I don't know if I learned it from Jeremiah or not, but I always say good to see you because I meet so many people in my restaurants and I can't remember everybody. I often remember a face, hopefully. But if I'm going to tell the story about the first time meeting Jeremiah, I think it might have been on one of the first times I actually dropped into the restaurant because I dropped in successive weeks, like every Tuesday over and over again. And it might have been one of those times. But I think my first impression of Jeremiah was this interesting observation of equality. Although Jeremiah was the boss and he was the face of the restaurant, he was very much involved in all aspects and was often tasting things with me. Or I remember one time blanching zucchini noodles, and those things soak up a lot of salt. I put a little too much salt in the blanching water, and he grabbed one. He's like, too salty. What are you doing? You know? And, you know, what kind of chef actually goes and tastes the zucchini noodles? So he was very, very involved. And so my initial impression of him was someone who had this leadership role and at the same time was very intertwined with all the kitchen people and all the whole restaurant because he flowed front and the back of the house. And, you know, you go into service and Jeremiah puts on the fresh jacket, rolls up the napkin, puts on the apron and starts, I'm not going to do this with the microphone, but slapping the napkin into his hand and holding the champagne. And he had this wonderful routine that went on every day. And the other thing that was fascinating about him, I learned very early, was that Jeremiah could spot a brown leaf of lettuce at 50 feet away.
True story.
Well, there's a story that's in my book that I was that I brought up with Mark and Clark that Andy Forsheimer tells about there was brown lettuce in the a salad one day that Andy had made, and JT made him eat it. and his point was, well, you wanted the customer to eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he said that a
lot. Thank you.
Yeah.
Jewel?
Let's see. Oops.
I was working in the Napa Valley at one of my brother's restaurants on the weekend, and Ken Hom was doing the East Meets West dinners there. And Ken said, you need to go and work at Santa Fe Bar and Grill. And so I went, very nervously went with my resume, which was, you know, nothing but family restaurants. And I met Jeremiah in the kitchen at Santa Fe, and we talked really just briefly. And because he had gotten a good reference from Ken, so I guess that was a good thing. I mean, Ken's a great guy. And then he talked to who, to Mark or to you, and Jeremiah said she's from the Midwest. She's got good work ethic. And so he, you know, I've been there from 91 until we went to Stars, and I left in 97. 81 to 87.
Whoa, yeah.
That resonates, right? That he kind of has this instinctual feeling about a lot of things, whether it's food, whether it's amazing wine, or it's people. You know, it really is. He is instinctually understands, sees it, expresses it, or doesn't express it, and just moves on. Like, and so I think that in his hiring practice, good people draw great people, right?
Well, and also the reason I asked that question I asked about was there a unifying thing is, I think in a lot of places there is a type, you know, like Keller, right? Mm-hmm. Keller's restaurants, all those people could be in the FBI, you know. It's like there's not a lot of the stuff that's become the normal accoutrement of like tattoos and piercings, and you don't see a lot of that in, you know, facial hair. You don't see a lot of that in Keller's. You see very nondescript.
Secret Service.
Yeah, no, they could be, you know, and but you don't see that kind of unifying thing about people who've worked, at, you know, from in the Stars alum. It's a much more diverse crew, personality wise, and yeah, style wise, and yeah. Anyway, Steve, first meeting.
I was working at Mark Miller's 4th Street Grill, and Lawrence DeVries said, Jeremiah's going to be taking over Santa Fe Bar and Grill. And I didn't really know Jeremiah or who Jeremiah was. He said, you really need to work with him. So after I did lunch, I walked over to the 4th Street, and Jeremiah had a table in the front of the Santa Fe on the lawn. And I don't remember. We talked for a while, and he said, well, if you come back tomorrow and if you want to work here. And so I was like, you know, I've got another job. So I come back the next day, and I go back in the kitchen, and Mark Franz is on a ladder washing the wall, and I just look around, I grab a bucket, I look up, I just start washing the baseboard, and Jeremiah walks by and stops, looks at me, and goes, wasn't expecting to see you here. So I guess that meant I was hired. And Mark and I hit it off, you know, yeah, instantly at that, yeah, point. And so that was 81.
And how did he strike you, JT, at first meeting?
You know, you're looking for a job. So, but it was that I always told everyone, it sounds too California, but it was like a past life. It's like, I know this, and I don't know why I know this, but this person is going to take me to this. And that's what he did. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, I know how to do this. Just, I got it. As soon as he talked about things, I got it. And so it was literally like a past life. As he brought me to that place.
I have to say, everybody's nodding as you say that.
He was such a gentleman all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there was very, very few times that, I mean, yeah, we saw him when he was, you know, crazy with just everything going on, but he was always such a gentleman about everything. He would stand by the, like when I was at the Santa Fe Bar and Grill, he would stand next to me and rub his back on the French fry cutter, you know, and watch me plate, and just, you know, always, you know, just lightly, if there was just some little thing wrong, just very nicely point it out to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was corrected, like, you know, like, mm-hmm, that. So we just knew that, you know, that his expectations.
I always did the grill at Santa Fe and later on at Stars. But after about 6 months, he said, you need to go, Steven, you need to go do cold salads. You're burning out. So, and he would stand against that potato slicer like a bear, you know, and just go up and down and scratch his back. And I'd be making salads. And finally, he looked at that damn chicken salad, the Green Goddess dressing, and he went, finally, that's it. And I was like, you know. And he touched a plate and went, plate's too warm, shoved it back at me. And I was just like, so I did the salad. I had no other tickets. I took off my apron, folded it up, said, I'll be right back. I walked around the parking lot, came back in, put on the apron, and he's doing that thing on the potato slicer, and he goes, all that over chicken salad? And he never hovered over me again for the next 15 years.
What was going to happen if you didn't go walk around the parking lot?
I would have probably gone what he loved to say is Tasmanian Varanian. I probably would have said
Tasmanian Varanian. What's the last thing? Let's go around the horn the other way. Well, you know, it's been a long time since these days, right? Yeah, but you guys are all still, I was talking to Mark and Clark before and saying, you know, I think there's very few restaurants where people who work there this much later are still, you know, like there's a Stars alum Facebook group. There's these periodic gatherings. I've seen some combination. We just met for the first time, Lisa, but I've seen some combination of a lot of you guys in other Stars get-togethers, you know, whether it was lunch at Zuni one day or the foreign cinema thing a couple of years ago. It's a pretty regular occurrence.
Yeah, at least yearly for us.
But what is it? But in terms of your professional life, in terms of your day-to-day, what do you think working with him, what's the biggest takeaway that still sort of informs what you do?
Professionally?
Yeah.
Well,
whether it's management, whether it's cooking, whether it's
negative to this.
Go ahead.
Because everyone expects you to be Jeremiah. Everyone wants the Stars experience. Everyone thinks that you can just cook it, put it on a plate, and it could be exactly as you did at Stars. But it ain't Stars, and it's not Jeremiah. And so many times for me professionally, I found myself, in order to get a job, I would have to try to be Stars and try to be Jeremiah. It took me a long time to find myself professionally because...
Right, because he casts a pretty big shadow.
Needed a job and that got me in the door. As it turned out, you know, you can't duplicate any of this stuff, and you got to find your own voice after a while.
Yeah,
so you got to be careful of working with someone in that dynamics and what people are expecting when they hire you, and how you can let them down, or more importantly, you let yourself down.
Mm. Thank you for that.
You got to find your own voice, and sometimes you don't, and that's fine, you know.
Yeah.
Also, but there's only, you know, one Jeremiah Tower. There's one Michael Jordan. There's one.
Yeah.
Joe Montana. It's not going to happen again.
Yeah.
It's going to happen in a different way, different space, different time. But it was family, and so much of us owe him. I mean, I met her because he hired Jewel.
Yeah. If I haven't said this in the intro, Stephen and Jewel are together now for years.
Yeah. Since that day at Santa Fe Bar and Grill. And our children are here because of him in a funny way.
Yeah.
There's a lot of indebtedness to Jeremiah.
Thank you. Jewel?
I would say I feel like when I have my own business, it is just... get up and do the best you can do and do it with pride and be happy. You know, just put your all into it every day. That's way kind of what my takeaway.
Great.
Short and sweet.
Thank you. Bruce?
I was going to say what she said, but what I'll say, because I think that's a really great part of what we maybe didn't realize when we worked at Stars, is that all we did was do our best every day. We were just chatting with Jeremiah while you were talking with Mark and Clark, and Jeremiah said, we didn't have a five-year or a two-year plan. We didn't know what we were even planning to do next month. We just knew what we were cooking with, and we knew that there was a schedule of people going to performances nearby who were going to hit us at certain times, and you know, all the really important parts of keeping a restaurant rolling, and especially the incredible turns of the tables that happened there, which was pretty remarkable because we were based on a lot of performances that came and went. But my takeaway from Stars is this master organizational framework that I got to understand after working there for a couple of years, and how all the different parts fit together, and how 14 cooks at night function all together and help each other and make this thing happen and serve sometimes 500 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty remarkable. It was definitely not happening anywhere else in town at that time.
And to Steve's point, you're involved in several restaurants.
Yeah.
I assume that you over the years have learned to take that, what do we call it, a mindset maybe, and adapt it to whatever the given situation requires at each individual place. I assume not all of your restaurants are run, maybe I'm wrong, but I assume not all your kitchens are run exactly the same way.
No, they're all run differently.
I mean, one, you're doing pizza at one of them.
Yeah, they have different configurations.
Yeah.
But regardless, they're all run with that base understanding that I learned at Starz, because once you learn that, you can't turn away from it because it's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
So you just end up doing it that way because you just know that that's the best way.
Lisa, I know you were in the front of the house, but...
I was. I share this story. What I find fascinating and what just completely resonates with me is that Jeremiah understood each of us as individuals, right? So when I was in my fourth year at Starz, and I really just needed a life change. I'm from San Francisco, born and raised, and I just wanted to go somewhere. And I decided I wanted to move to Chicago. And I said to him, I said, JT, I think I want to move to Chicago. And he, without missing a beat, looked right at me and said, well, you need to go work for Richard Melman. And he understood that what Rich did, which was the systems, the operations, the plan, the training, the development, they had mastered that, right? Like, I always say it was sixes and sevens when I showed up at Let Us Entertain You, and we were doing nines, tens, and elevens at Starz, you know, culinarily, certainly. But he understood that if I was ever going to really be like have longevity in the restaurant industry, I would have to learn labor cost, food cost, inventory control, performance and talent management, all these things. And that we sort of, that were innate because we all individually just desired to be great when we worked at Starz. But there was no systems and operations in place. We were winging it. JT just said, we were winging it. Like, we didn't know. We were just having a good time, you know, like giving the best experience possible. And the other thing that I love that he said to me, he pulled me aside one time. And he said, Lisa, nobody should have a different dining experience at 6:30 on a Tuesday night than they do at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. He goes, that's why Green Cell sounds so good right now. Like, he was just, he knew that even if the room was half full at that hour, at that moment, that those people mattered that were sitting there, just like the people that were going to the opera, the ballet, and the symphony on Saturday night did. And he wanted them to enjoy and have that amazing experience.
I think it's fascinating that he sent you to Melman.
Right?
Because, I mean,
speaks to what he knew I needed personally.
I mean, people who don't know, Melman is a huge restaurateur based in Chicago.
Yes.
Kind of known for themey places. Like early on, he had a place called Ed DeBevick's.
Ed DeBevick. I was at Scusi, the Big Red Tomato. We were doing 500, 600, 700 Italian dinners a night.
A lot of Italian-y places.
He had Hat Dance, which was a Mexican.
Yeah. But they're
and then he did Maggiano's when I was there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the last place you would think of somebody like Jeremiah identifying with, but I could see where he would appreciate the how it worked, you know.
100%.
Yeah.
And then when, just to bring this back around, I tell people I have the hat trick because I work for JT, I work for Rich Melman, and then I went on to work for Wolfgang Puck. Mm. And David Robbins was the chef, the corporate chef when I walked in.
This is a long time Puck.
Yes,
chef.
Yes. Yeah. But he was a sous chef at Starz when I was at Starz. And I walked into, my former husband had gotten transferred to Vegas, so we were moving to Vegas. He was in a different industry. And I walked into Spago, and David walked down that big staircase. And he looks at me and says, what are you doing here? And I said, before I could even say it, he said, did you just move here? I said, I did. He said, where are you working? I said, I don't know. He said, can you start tomorrow? I'm like, sure. Literally, that was my interview at Spago, because he knew where I came from.
Yeah.
We all came from the same place.
Yes.
He knew how I was trained.
Yeah.
So that speaks volumes.
Yeah. So
the family speaks volumes.
I have a question for the group. We'll figure out how to make these mics work. But
you know, well, I'm not saying anything out of school. It's in his books, right? Jeremiah had a very fraught relationship with his father, wasn't very fond of him. Jeremiah was gay at a time when it was not a normal thing for parenthood to be in the realm of the possible. Do you guys, is there a parental element to this relationship? Do you think he sees you guys that way, and do you think of him that way?
Absolutely, 100%. 100%. Jeremiah was like my wonderful gay father that I found when I moved to San Francisco. You know, one of the funny things, you talk about how people advised people of our generation not to be chefs, and that was a crappy career and you're going to be looked down on and stuff like that. What people told me when I said I was moving to San Francisco is they said, don't get a tattoo. And I never did. When I met Jeremiah, I was thin, like 140 pounds. I had bleach blonde hair. And a lot of people thought I was gay. And so although I was straight, I had this really wonderful kind of flirtatious relationship with Jeremiah back then, and it was great. It was like totally free. It was super hard work, and at the same time, there was this other dynamic to it. So yeah, it was a complicated fatherly relationship for me. That was really wonderful. And you know, they talked about travel earlier too. Jeremiah sent me to France for the first time, and that was a wonderful gift that he gave me. That I don't know if anyone else would have given me, but it was wonderful.
What was the question again?
Oh, whether it was a fatherly relationship.
Yeah, this. You can see it more with Mark and Jeremiah. But Mark was Jeremiah's father. It was the other way around.
You have to explain who Mark was.
So Mark Franz, at the time, was the executive chef, even though we really didn't have titles back then, but became known as executive chef at Starz. He was Jeremiah's right-hand man, and he got the culinary aspects of the food, of the flavors, of presentation, and basically did all the menus at Starz after the first year or so. But that was a really interesting relationship. But like what Bruce said, yeah, there's a lot of times where I felt like I was his brother more than a son. There was that flirtatious element that went both ways, that you knew you weren't going to get in trouble too bad if you could kind of flirt a little bit, or he flirted with you and you felt pretty good about it. It was like, you know, it was his way of saying good job, because you didn't really, it wasn't a lot of high five. Well, you didn't high five in those days, right? But it was just expected of you. Or maybe because it was, you know, the first generation of us had gone through that more at Santa Fe than at Starz. But yeah, there was a brother, there was a son, there was a father type of role playing there.
It was familial.
Yeah.
And I think front of the house too, Tony and Gotti had that relationship with JT very much so, sort of father-son type relationship. And that definitely resonated with all of us front of the house. And it's funny that you mentioned that thing about Europe, Bruce. My sister had graduated from culinary school at CIA when I was at Starz, and my parents wanted to take us on a month-long tour of Europe after she graduated, and take me and my sisters. And I said to JT, I said, my parents want us to go to Europe for 4 weeks. He's like, absolutely. And then he gave me, you must go to La Capole, and you must go to, and he gave me sort of this list. And he recognized that those are experiences. We'll figure it out. We'll, you know, we'll cover you. You go be you. And he knew that those are irreplaceable experiences that will only benefit us and our career and the place of our passion, you know. And
yeah,
it was fabulous. And he didn't even think twice. In this day and age, you're like, can I take a vacation, or do I have enough vacation time?
Right.
Jeremiah knew that was an educational, once in a lifetime, you go.
Great. All right. Does someone have something?
I was just going to say, my relationship, or towards the end or all the time, I grew up with a lot of brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great parents. They were, you know, everything to me. And so I think I felt like he was like my really rich, just
uncle or brother that was just going to do whatever needed to be, you know, just he's so gracious, you know. That's how I feel.
Great. Thank you. All right, everybody. Thank you very much. And that's our show for this week. I want to thank all our guests, Ed Levine, Jeremiah Tower, Clark Frazier, Mark Gehr, Lisa Sheehan, Stephen and Jewel Vranian, and Bruce Hill, to our engineer, Jeep Paul. Thanks for splicing this thing together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. And if you feel like it, I would really love if you threw us a review or just a rating on iTunes to help people find the show. And I will see you back here next week, if not sooner, on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrationing happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.